We're convening the Natural Resources Committee at the 1 o'clock. Present with us is Representative Edgman, Coring, Seaton, Roses, Wilson, and Co-Chair Gatto. First of all, I want to say welcome. I do appreciate you, your attendance here. This is kind of a day I've been looking forward to. I think Exxon is a major player, and we have a person who's testified before and certainly has practiced at it, and I'm looking forward to the presentation. With that, I'm going to set up some boundaries, and that is, and I know I'm pretty sure it's okay with you, sir, that at some point we interrupt you and we say, do we back up 1 second? I have a question. Is that all right with you? Fine. With that, would you mind then taking your turn in the barrel? Introduce yourself, your affiliation, and for the record, Mr. Massey has told me that, because I've asked him some time back as to whether he can actually sign for Exxon should we reach a point where we have an agreement, and he actually said yes, he could. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
That is an amazing statement. I just love to hear. Representative Roses, did you have a question? Oh, new people? Yeah. Representative Kawasaki and Representative Co-Chair Johnson have joined us, and we're all only one shy at this point. But Mr. Massey, please introduce yourself, your affiliation, and then go ahead. By the way, did you have a half hour, an hour? If you talk continuously, when would you be done?
Probably 20, 25 minutes,
okay.
Something like that.
Appreciate that.
Is that okay?
That is excellent.
Okay. Good afternoon, Chairman Gatto and Co-Chair Johnson and members of the House Resources Committee. My name is Marty Massey. I am the U.S. Joint Interest Manager for ExxonMobil, a position I have held since November 2001, and I am responsible for the commercialization of ExxonMobil's gas resources in Alaska. ExxonMobil has been in Alaska for over 50 years. And has been a key player in Alaska's oil industry development. We hold the largest working interest at Prudhoe Bay, and our current net production in Alaska is approximately 150,000 barrels per day. We have benefited from our involvement in the state of Alaska, and we believe that Alaska has benefited from this long-term relationship as well. Commercializing Alaska's North Slope gas will allow us to continue this mutually beneficial relationship for another 50 years or more. Let me emphasize that ExxonMobil wants a successful gas pipeline project, and we want to move it forward. The Alaska Gas Pipeline Project is important to Alaska, to our nation, and to ExxonMobil. The project has the potential to generate billions of dollars in revenues for the state of Alaska, the U.S. federal government, and Canada, and could provide a stable and secure source of clean energy for Alaska and North America for decades to come. For ExxonMobil, the project has the potential to add over 1 billion cubic feet a day of gas sales, which would be more than a 10% increase in our current daily gas production. Given the significant impact this project could have on our business, we strongly support efforts to advance a pipeline project, and we are ready to work with Governor Palin, her cabinet, and the legislature to move the project forward. As an illustration of our commitment, ExxonMobil has spent more than $180 million studying ways to commercialize Alaska gas. Since the 1970s, we have evaluated LNG, gas to liquids, and gas pipeline alternatives. Based on these studies, we have determined that a producer gas pipeline project will result in the best value for the state, the producers, and the nation. It is important for me to say ExxonMobil is aligned with the governor, the legislature, and the people of Alaska regarding the overall objective. We are committed to moving the Alaska gas pipeline project forward. ExxonMobil embraces the concept of competition all over the world and is ready to participate in a fair, market-based competition. We understand the overarching goal of AGEA is to create open competition. But due to the prescribed conditions included in AGEA, it will not achieve this goal. A prescriptive bidding process will not allow the flexibility needed for individual applicants to weigh the risk associated with this basin opening mega project and propose what is necessary to manage these risks. It is important that AGEA allow applicants to define how they could achieve the state's objectives rather than prescribing specific requirements that must be met. To ensure the best result, AGEA should establish broad key objectives and allow applicants flexibility in meeting those objectives and in defining the requirements that are necessary to make the project commercially viable. If you were to amend AGEA to make it objective-driven, it would result in open competition, maximizing the number of applicants and allowing those applicants to propose innovative solutions. As such, we suggest AGEA be modified to establish an objective-driven process. Define the state's broad objectives. Request proposals as to how applicants intend to meet or not meet those objectives. Evaluate the proposals and then select the one that best serves Alaska's needs. If none meet the state's overall objectives, then you can always reject them. Or you can opt to negotiate with the party that most closely meets your needs.
Mr. Massey, since we said we could interject at times, first of all, we're joined by Representative Guttenberg. Number two is there are 20 objectives that any bidder has been asked to meet. Are you saying those are not objectives, they're not broad enough, or what is the issue that you have with the 20 that are included in the AGEA?
What we would describe as the state's broad key objectives, which are laid out in AGEA, relate to this. You want to make sure that you deliver the most value from the project for the state. That's objective, one objective. You want to make sure you have gas for Alaskans. You want to make sure that people can access to the pipe such that explorers can get their gas down the pipeline. You want to make sure that Alaskans will have the opportunity for the jobs that the pipeline creates. We would say those are the broad key objectives that you should describe. And then you should allow the applicants to lay out for you how they intend to meet those objectives. And we would go no further than that in terms of laying out what the requirements should be.
So the remaining 15, then, you feel personally you would like to see deleted, and if they were deleted, you would say, I'm here, here's my proposal?
Yes, sir.
Thank you. Question from Representative Seaton.
Thank you. Mr. Massey, my understanding is that there's nothing that prevents you from coming forward with that proposal or proposal right now to build a pipeline under those conditions. And so I'm and it hasn't happened, so I'm a little I'm scratching my head a little bit to find the why this bill should be modified when you have the ability to come forward and make a proposal to the state right now to build a pipeline, and how does that, can you explain that to me?
Representative Seaton, through the chair, we've been asked to participate in an open competitive process which has been laid out in the AGEA. We've not been asked to provide a proposal that meets our needs. We've done that once before, and you can refer to that as the old fiscal contract. But the process that the administration has laid out is an open, transparent, competitive process, which we're ready to participate in, as long as we're allowed to participate in such a way that we can describe what is necessary for us to make the project commercially viable, as well as describe how we would intend to meet the state's objectives. If we're going to have an open competitive process, which is the way you want to go, then that's how we need to participate. It would not be in our best interest to participate outside of the open competitive process when that's the direction the state is trying to go.
Do you have a follow-up?
Yeah, I guess so. I'm still not quite clear. If you want to make a proposal that is radically different than what's put forward in this open competitive process, if you want to make a proposal based on all of your own needs and desires, there is, my understanding is there's nothing that prevents you from making that proposal to the state right now, and the state has been anxious to have a gas line proposal before it for many years. And so I'm trying to figure out what would make this, modifying this bill, a vehicle for you to make a proposal that you've been able to make to the state for many years. And I just don't quite understand why this proposal should be modified to do what you already have the ability to do.
Representative Seaton, through the chair, it's no more complicated than this is the process the administration has elected to follow, and we need to participate in that process. It's no more complicated than that.
Thank you for that. The AGEA bill was introduced on April 4th, so it's only been in existence for about a month and a week. Prior to April 4th, and actually even since April 4th, anyone, I'm not picking on Exxon, but anyone could come forth and say, we have a plan here that involves several people that we've spoken to, including Exxon and Conoco, and it could be an independent contractor that says, here's our plan to move the gas from where it is to where it's needed. Is that something that, and I guess what I'm getting at is there's some advantage for you to move gas on the North Slope to where it's needed, or is there some disadvantage for you, meaning Exxon, to move gas from where it is to where it's needed? In that it's a free and open market, does the introduction of new gas somehow prove detrimental to Exxon's ability to sell existing gas at a higher price? In other words, how do you maximize the benefit to your company? So I'm sorry if the question is there a disadvantage to you in actually moving forward at this time, or is it an advantage, as I think I've heard you say?
Representative Gatto, it's an advantage for us to move the project forward when it's commercially viable.
And I'm going to ask a slightly different question. How do we determine, is it, because gas, I think, is $7.94 right now. No one here knows what the gas is tomorrow or next month or next year or 10 years or 30 years when we finally start moving the bulk of it. Not start moving, but have moved the bulk of it. So we'll never know if it's commercially viable because it depends entirely on the amount we can sell it for. Since no one knows that, at what point would you determine that it's commercially viable?
Representative Gatto, commercial viability takes a number of different factors that you look at. It starts with your ability to mitigate the risk associated with the project. Do you feel like you can execute the project within a range of costs that you project? Does the project over the range of costs that you look at versus a range of different gas prices that you might think could occur in the future, does it make sense to go forward? And it's a combination of all of those, your ability to execute the project, mitigate risk associated with that execution, the range of costs versus range of prices. And do you, in your judgment, does your assessment of those factors in your mind say that it's viable? And if it does, you go forward. If it doesn't, you don't.
Okay. And I'm going to guess it's fair to say that you do this all day long, is look at the contributing factors and say, you know, we're getting to the point where I'm becoming a fan of the AGEA proposal, or I'm losing interest. And I think that's, if I'm correct, that's essentially what you do. Or is that done in the boardroom in Houston, or is it done over 5,000 people who get together and contribute the information? It sounds pretty complicated, or is it simpler, such as, listen, this is a decision made by one person, and I'm the guy?
Representative Gatto, obviously you take input from all your experts in all of the categories that I've mentioned, and that gets weighed and discussed within your company and a set of folks that look at that get together and make a decision as to whether they think it's viable or not, based on the input that they received from the experts that worked that particular problem.
Okay, and I'm going to agree it's a very tough thing to do, because you make the decision only once, and then
you're done.
You're out there doing what you have to do. The baseball game is in the first inning, but we're on our way. And I'm sorry for taking this long, so please continue with your presentation.
Okay, thank you. To understand why it's important to use broad objectives as opposed to prescribing specific requirements, it is helpful to review project risk and issues surrounding its development that will have to be addressed by an applicant. Because there is a perception that this is simply a gas treating gas pipeline project, the tendency exists for many to underestimate the size, magnitude, and risk associated with this undertaking. The Alaska Gas Pipeline Project is a world-scale undertaking with significant risk. In fact, the project will be the largest private investment in North America, significantly larger than most model worldwide oil and gas mega projects. There is not really another project that compares. Because of this size, many factors impact commercial viability, and we've talked about some of those. First, there's cost. Our previous estimate of $20 billion in 2001 dollars is now substantially higher. Since 2001, steel prices have nearly doubled. Industry and construction labor costs are experiencing hyperinflation. In addition, worldwide mega projects are placing pressure on pricing and availability of global materials and skilled manpower. Next, there's gas price. Despite recent increases, natural gas prices remain highly volatile. The price of natural gas before 2000 was lower than the estimated gas treating and transportation costs. Finally, there are many other risks. These include cost overruns, schedule delays, construction conditions, and regulatory and state fiscal uncertainties. It is also important to note that investments will have to be made over a period of 10 or more years before gas flows down the pipeline and is sold at the marketplace. With size comes complexity and even greater premium on getting the design concept, contracting, and marketing plans right, and then executing these plans efficiently and effectively. Most importantly, size also amplifies the consequences of poor execution. If a mistake is made on this project, it will cost us all dearly. The state of Alaska cannot anticipate how individual applicants will view these risks or how they may address them. Establishing a set of rigid, prescribed terms will not allow the flexibility needed for individual applicants to weigh and manage those risks. It is also important to understand how pipelines are financed, which is a key reason why AGIA should allow flexibility in proposing upstream terms. Commercially sound oil and gas pipeline projects traditionally have been able to obtain financing if they have strong sponsors with proven track records and the financial strength to provide sponsor equity and to backstop key project commitments. For the Alaska Gas Pipeline Project, key project commitments take the form of firm, long-term gas transportation commitments. Firm transportation commitments are binding obligations made by companies to pay for the cost of reserving a quantity of gas capacity as shippers on a pipeline over a specified period of time, typically many years. These commitments are made during an open season, which according to the FERC Order 2005 for the Alaska Gas Pipeline is a period of at least 90 days during which any and all prospective gas shippers can make these binding commitments for a specified volume of transportation capacity. Financial institutions generally require substantial, long-term, firm transportation commitments to provide funding for a gas pipeline project. These commitments must be provided by creditworthy shippers. In this case, the shippers will be the producers, and directly or indirectly, the state or the state shipper. These firm transportation commitments are substantial, tens of billions of dollars, and must be paid whether the shipper making those commitments actually transports the gas through its reserve capacity. The shipper is also required to pay this commitment regardless of the price of gas in the marketplace. Pipeline investors use these firm transportation commitments from shippers to show creditors they have the capacity confirmed over a sufficient duration to secure financing, and must rely on the financial strength of the companies backing the transportation commitments to secure project financing. Thus, the development costs and the associated overrun risk are ultimately borne by the shipper via this commitment. In other words, shippers must make long-term shipper-pay transportation commitments and agree to pay that are based on the ultimate costs on the pipeline and the treating facilities. The only information known in advance of making these commitments will be a projection based on the each project entity's initial estimate of costs.
While you have that pause, just to say I wanted to thank Representative Fairclough. She was here for the previous hearing. She's here today. I'm always happy to see another legislator show the intense interest that's there, so appreciate that.
We believe for that reason the parties taking the risk need to be able to manage those risks. The producers as shippers cannot make firm transportation commitments during open season unless they are confident the gas pipeline can be built cost effectively and operated on a long-term commercially viable basis, including being competitive with other sources of supply. This is especially true for a project of this magnitude. The existing prescriptive terms will preclude leaseholders from being able to make a conforming proposal, which would deny the state the opportunity to even consider terms from the parties who hold the largest stake in the project's successful development. Let me talk about the importance of alignment between the state and the producers and the benefits of a producer project. Maximizing the value to the state of Alaska and the resource holder means selecting the right design concept for this mega project and then executing the project to deliver the lowest possible cost. On a mega project of this size and magnitude, project construction and operating experience should be a significant consideration. Only a limited number of companies have demonstrated the capabilities and financial strength to effectively participate in and manage world-scale projects.
And Mr. Massey, of all those possibilities, that are currently in Alaska with gas in the ground, is Exxon the only one in your mind that could do this?
Representative Gatto, the fact that ExxonMobil is a large resource owner, also holds the largest discovered gas resource. I think the state of Alaska is very fortunate in that because it's ExxonMobil that will put up, you know, the big firm transportation commitment along with BP and ConocoPhillips, who also have a large stake. The three of us together, you know, can make this project happen. ExxonMobil cannot do it by itself. We cannot do it without BP or ConocoPhillips. It's going to take all three of us.
I guess that's the answer to the question. Would Exxon or could Exxon do it independently and say, here's the bid, we want to build the pipeline, and with our background experience, know-how, and resources, it's as good as done, and then proceed?
Representative Gatto, it takes ExxonMobil, BP, ConocoPhillips, and the state of Alaska. Until we are all aligned on the project, it just is not going to happen.
Thank you. That's important for us to hear.
The producers have mega project experience on numerous projects worldwide and have demonstrated success in meeting project objectives. For example, ExxonMobil operates in nearly 200 countries and territories and on every continent except Antarctica. We are the world's largest non-government producer of both oil and natural gas. ExxonMobil's global development company is unique within the industry. This global development company leads the industry in project cost and schedule performance. Nearly 90% of ExxonMobil's projects with costs greater than $1 billion are delivered within 15% of the estimated costs at the time of project funding, and nearly 80% of those were delivered within 15% of the funding schedule. ExxonMobil's superior performance was independently validated in a report published by Sanford C. Bernstein & Company. On the topic of project delays, the report stated, ExxonMobil came out on top of the analysis. with the lowest slippage rate, despite undertaking some of the largest projects. We believe this to be a direct result of its highly competent internal development company, which assumes full responsibility for monitoring a new project from idea to profit. Combining our capability with BP and ConocoPhillips will provide the best chance of delivering a successful project. The producers also have Arctic experience in Alaska and throughout the world. ExxonMobil's Arctic experience is extensive, over 40 years, with developments in multiple types of Arctic environments. Our Arctic offshore activity started in 1966 with the installation of the ice-resistant Granite Point platform in Alaska's Cook Inlet, which is still producing oil today. In the 1970s, we provided a significant amount of research and engineering for the Prudhoe Bay project, where our completion designs for permafrost were of key importance to the project. We also developed the combined hydraulic flow model and thermal simulator on which the design of TAPS was based. In 1984, we installed the Concrete Island Drilling System, CIDS, to drill exploration wells in Alaska Beaufort Sea. In addition to our Arctic experience in Alaska, ExxonMobil also has extensive Arctic experience in Canada, developing the Norman Wells field in the Mackenzie River area near the Arctic Circle. Offshore Newfoundland, we completed the Hibernia platform, the first and only iceberg-resistant offshore structure in the world. In Russia, we recently started up Sakhalin 1 development, which involved an offshore drilling platform where CIDS, believe it or not, was reused and renamed Arlen, an onshore drill site where we set new industry limits for extended reach drilling, an onshore oil and gas plant with a capacity of 250,000 barrels per day, and purpose-built tankers which are used year-round. All of this work being done in Arctic and seismically active area. At Sakhalin, we're currently producing 250,000 barrels of oil per day, exactly the design capacity. I hope you'll see from these examples that large projects with significant complexity are what we do, and we are extremely qualified to take on this work. These successful efforts were the result of a long-term commitment to technology development, which has played an important role in the advancement of oil and gas development in Alaska. ExxonMobil believes innovation is the key to meeting the world's energy challenges. Technology is the lifeblood of our industry, and it always has been. We are the leader in our industry in technology development. 2006, we spent $730 million on technology development, and we have spent more than $3 billion since 2002. In addition, ExxonMobil has demonstrated world-class leadership in safety, health, and environmental performance. ExxonMobil is a leader in operating efficiency and a pace-setter in operating safety. Our total recordable incident rates for employees and contractors are substantially below the average of U.S. petroleum industry benchmark of participating API companies. We believe a company's commitment to the highest standards of safety, health, and environmental care manifests itself in superior performance in all aspects of its operations. In addition to our operational excellence, ExxonMobil has the financial strength to make this project a reality. We have consistently maintained one of the strongest financial positions of any company in the world. We are one of just a few public companies to maintain the highest credit rating from Standard & Poor's and Moody's, and we have done so for each of the last 88 years. Unparalleled access to financial resources gives us the flexibility to pursue opportunities worldwide throughout the economic cycle, with the knowledge that they can be financed. Host governments recognize this strength and its importance as they look to develop their resources and economies. As an example of that strength, ExxonMobil project financing experience exceeds $30 billion in value for recently completed and ongoing activities. Our efficient management of large-scale project financing is a critical piece in the overall success of ExxonMobil's project implementation record. It is important to remember that the Alaska Gas Pipeline Project is a basin opening project that will benefit the state and the oil industry in Alaska. Basin opening projects throughout the world have progressed and been successful when there is alignment between the host government and the leaseholders. The producers in the state both want a pipeline project to commercialize the known ANS gas resources and open the basin to gas exploration. So at a very high level, we are aligned. We believe a producer gas pipeline project will result in maximum value to the state and the producers. The reason is the producers and the state have maximum incentive to control costs. Low capital and operating costs, which result in lower tariff and lower treating and transportation costs, and access to the premium market price, result in higher netback value on the gas. It should be noted that the state will receive the majority of its revenue from the value of the gas sales via revenue received under the lease royalty agreements and from production taxes, which are valued based on the netback received from the gas. Third-party owners do not share the same incentives in that they actually benefit from the increased capital cost. Based on the demand for workers that this project will generate, Alaskans are obviously key to successful project execution. Both the state and the producers want Alaskans to benefit from the many job opportunities that will exist. When you consider carefully the options available, a producer pipeline will provide maximum value to the state of Alaska. We believe that financial strength, experience, and ability to get the job done should be critical components of any evaluation of proposals. For us to progress the project and mitigate its inherent risk, we will need some things from the state. Let me discuss the importance of predictable and durable fiscal terms for the upstream participants. Because of the nature and magnitude of the risk associated with this project, tens of billions of dollars of financial commitments, unprecedented costs and scope, potential for construction delays, as well as the inevitable risk associated with the commodity price of gas, fiscal terms that are predictable and durable are necessary. This is a common thread for all of our major project investments in basin opening developments. In all such cases, we are willing to take geologic risk, we are willing to take cost risk, and we are willing to take commodity price risk, but we cannot take the risk of fiscal terms changing. Let me expand on this important concept further. The first two risks, geologic and cost risk, are risks for which we have developed an industry-leading expertise to manage. This is what we do day after day at ExxonMobil. Market risk is inevitable in a commodity business such as oil and gas. We try to manage that by attempting to put our products in the highest value markets. Fiscal risk, however, is of a completely different nature and wholly outside of our control. We must have agreements that will allow us to develop this mega project under predictable and durable terms so that we can make an adequate investment decision. If fiscal terms can be changed in the future, then we are not able to make a well-founded investment decision on behalf of our shareholders. The Alaska Gas Pipeline project will require massive investments to be made over a period of many years before any revenue is generated from those investments. As a result, increases in taxes on oil and gas-related activities during the life of the project could significantly impact the commercial viability of the project and offset the benefits of taking on the project of this magnitude in the first place. Because fiscal terms could be modified under the PROSAGEA legislation, it does not provide the predictable and durable fiscal terms necessary to ensure a commercially viable project.
Let me interrupt you here. My understanding, and this is debated somewhat fervently in Senate Judiciary yesterday, about the ability to make a tax rate for 10 years and whether or not that will pass judicial review, both the U.S. and the state. If indeed it was okay to put in the legislation a 10-year certainty for taxes, is that sufficient for you or still insufficient?
Representative Gatto, as I understand AGEA, what is proposed is 10 years on the gas production tax.
Correct.
Obviously, there are more forms to take within the state of Alaska than just gas production tax. The recognition of some form of fiscal stability is obviously very good because the state has recognized that something needs to be done in this area. But to lock in one piece of the take and leave all the other pieces of the take open really doesn't provide any fiscal stability because it can just be changed in another form of the take. So what we're talking about is we have to agree how we're going to share the revenue generated from this project over the life of the project. What revenue is going to the state? What revenue is going to come to the producers? until we know that, we can't make a good investment decision. We don't know how to even run the economics if we don't know what the terms are going to be. I may have to assume in our economics that they will go up unless we agree that they're not going to go up. So that is the issue. And on a mega project of this magnitude, $20-30 billion, it's just too big of a risk to take. We have to know what the deal is so we can make a good investment decision.
Can you at least give me some examples of other jurisdictions where the certainty you're asking for, which I'm longer than 10 years and maybe for the life of the project, already exists?
Representative Gatto, I would refer you to the interim fiscal finding that was done as part of our last effort. In that interim fiscal finding, there is an analysis of across the world where these sort of arrangements have been done, and there are many, especially on mega projects of this magnitude. It's not unusual to see terms much longer than 35 years, and none of those projects really compare to this project that we're trying to take on. There's a very detailed analysis included in the interim fiscal finding that describes, you know, across the world, maybe 50 or so different contracts that were evaluated.
I did see that. I was also looking at the names of the places where they provided much more certainty. But they were places where you could provide, well, many of them, you could provide certainty, but the political system was unstable enough so that certainty was as long as till the next person, dictator, military coup were to come about. And then the entire project is jeopardized in its entirety, not just as a percentage of it. So I recognize that. But how about in Europe and in places that are considered politically stable? Are there examples of a long-term stability in the taxing structure for places that are similar to the U.S., the U.K., et cetera?
Representative Gatto, if this project was in the U.K. or in Texas, we would still require the same sort of understanding. It just relates to the type of project we're trying to take on. Mm-hmm. It's not simply a one-well drill well and that we're trying to get done in West Texas. This is a $20 or $30 billion sort of deal that we're trying to do. So it really doesn't matter. I'm not aware of any mega project investments, you know, recently in the UK that would even compare to something of this magnitude. That's how I would answer your question.
Right. Is there some benefit, though, the fact that the reserves are proven? It's not a matter of saying we really suspect that there is quite a bit of gas located here. Let's put together a development plan and move and hope that it's there. And that, of course, would be somewhat different from proven reserves.
Representative Gatto, obviously that helps this project a lot, because when you talk about reserve risks or geologic risks, that's one of the risks that, when you look at it, you don't have as much concern with. We have in the range of 35 TCF a discovered resource. That's not enough. We need 50,
right,
you know, to kind of fill it up for the period that we're looking at, the 35 years. None of us are too concerned about being able to find that gas based on the estimates of gas that's on the North Slope, but it's still an issue that we're going to have to find more gas to, you know, keep the pipe full. So, yeah, it does help, and it's one of the factors when you look at commercial viability. When it comes to resource risk, you probably give us a good mark in that category, given we've got the gas. And at Prudhoe, we've seen a lot of it come up to the surface and go back in the ground.
Right. Representative Seaton has a question.
Thank you. Since, you know, we're talking about fiscal terms, tax changes, looking at the production tax, which is what's included in this bill, is your concern that on page 21 here, under the gas production tax exemption, that there's a perception that between the time the license is issued and the open season, there will be a reevaluation of the tax, or that there might be a change in tax, and that's what's in fact contemplated in that gas production tax exemption. And would you be more comfortable with fixing the rate at the time of licensing for, say, 3 years until you have to be at open season? And then if you are a successful successful bidder, the successful bidders at open season could get fiscal certainty at that same rate for 10 years. Is that the kind of thing that's setting so that you know, so that you take away that uncertainty? Or is it not just the uncertainty, but a negotiation on rate that you're wanting?
Representative Seaton, there's many different ways to skin this cat. I mean, when you say lock in the rate, some people get a little nervous about that. It makes you uncomfortable. The rate could change over time. It's knowing what the rate will be when we start this project, in whatever form of take that we have to pay to the state of Alaska, be it income tax, production tax, property tax, knowing what that rate will be and agreeing to what that rate will look like. It can be flat, declining, increasing, whatever, as long as the rate that we ultimately agree results in a commercially viable project, so that I know what it is so I can go back and run the economics and determine if it's viable or not. What I have today is I don't know. I really don't know what rate to run the economics at, because it can change. All of them can change. And on a mega project like this, to make a sound, fundamental, good decision, I have to know.
Representative Seaton has a follow-up.
Okay, and I kind of understand this, and I think I'm hearing your answer to my question as that the section on page 21 of gas production tax exemption is problematic for you because it does anticipate that there could be a tax rate change between license and open season. So would the certainty, at least on this section of the tax, of a provision that said the tax rate at the time of licensing will continue unchanged for 3 years, which would take you to the open season, and successful bidders at open season would be assured that they would have 10 years of that same tax rate on gas production. Is that the kind of surety and elimination of the risk of fluctuation that would give you the kind of certainty that you're looking for? It may not be the ideal, but would that provision satisfy the needs of Exxon?
Representative Seaton through the chair, you've pointed out two uncertainties. One is at the beginning. You don't know what it could be while you're spending the money trying to get to an open season. Obviously, you'd like to remove that uncertainty so that, you know, when you're spending money, you know what the ultimate tax rate is going to be. But you also have the uncertainty around 10 years. 10 years is not adequate for a project of this magnitude. We need to decide what the term is going to be for the whole, you know, for the life of the project. What is our take going to be for the life of the project so we can run the economics? And you're just talking about one form of take. That's the production tax rate. There's other forms of take that this project will generate, you know, revenue to the state, income tax, property tax, and so forth. If that's the system we elect to model, then we have to define what those are going to be as well.
And just one other follow-up. So is your testimony to us that if we decide, if we're told that it's unconstitutional to tie this up for 35 or 40 years, the life of the project, then you're just not interested and that you will not participate? I mean, that's what I'm hearing, and I don't know if that's what you're meaning to say, but that's what I'm hearing, is if we can't give you lock in all the tax rates for the life of the project, that ExxonMobil will not be at least a participant under the pipeline. and maybe even as a seller or producer. Could you explain?
Yeah, Representative Seaton, the constitutionality issue is one that will ultimately be resolved in court. I don't think there's, you know, any question about that. I would say that, you know, the Stranded Gas Act was there. It had a 35-year term with it. It was based upon the Constitution. You know, legal opinions delivered, you know, in two prior administrations indicated that they thought it would be constitutional. Our own view is that it will be constitutional to agree, you know, what the revenue share is going to be over the term of the project. But that's not 100%. The court will ultimately rule on that. We believe that they will rule that it can be done. If it can't be done, then we'll have to go back and see what else do we need. What else can we do? Will the court give us some advice in that ruling that will give us a clue as to what we need to do to make it work, and then we can adjust based upon that advice.
Thank you, Representative Roses, and then followed by Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you, through the chair. I don't know whether it's fortunate or unfortunate, but I wasn't part of the discussions that went on last year in the marathon session. But, you know, I keep trying to equate this back to my experience in businesses that I've owned and in trying to finance businesses. And I understand the fiscal uncertainty issue that you bring up. And I also understand the dynamic about whether or not it's constitutional. And unfortunately, my biggest fear is that we do have to go to courts to get all these resolved, which means nobody moves because we sit here forever waiting for a decision and then an appeal and then on and on and on. I guess looking at it from my business experience perspective, the only way I can see that you would get around the possibility of the uncertainty of future tax rate changes and the uncertainty of the volatility of the market, whether the market goes up or down, it would be that if there was some sort of a percentage sharing of volume of the product, so that if the state says, okay, we're not going to charge an income tax, we're not going to charge your production tax, but we're going to take 30% of your product or 25% of your product or 40% of your product, does that then become a measurable quantity that you can then determine the financial viability of this project?
Representative Roses, through the chair, let me clarify one thing. On the judicial challenge in our last contract that we cut, we committed to continue the project even while the judicial challenge was ongoing. We said if we got to a certain spend, and I can't recall the number at this point as to how many dollars it would, then we might have to stop if we didn't have a decision. But because of the confidence that we believed it would be constitutional, we were ready to risk a significant sum of money while that judicial challenge related to the constitution of taxes was going on. So we were willing to do that. You're absolutely right in terms of, in my view, of a way to share the risk. And if the state takes their taxes and the revenue from this project in their share of the gas, then that eliminates a lot of the other issues. And I think it's a great alignment in terms of aligning the state and the producers in the overall objective of trying to make this this project a reality from my standpoint. So I agree with you completely.
Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you. Well, unfortunately or fortunately, I was here through the last administration's attempts to deal with a contract under the Stranded Gas Act. And from my perspective, those negotiations are examples of why third world nations are destabilized. But, and I'm waiting for still an answer to Representative Gatto's answer on where in Western democracies are these fiscal certainties in contracts. But my question is, if we go ahead and we give a 10-year commitment to taxes, and the courts find that it is not constitutional, do you consider that a point when you can withdraw out of a contract, or would you continue to go ahead?
Representative Guttenberg, if the courts decide that, you know, that tax structure, wherever we end up, is not constitutional, then we'll have to revisit at that point in time in terms of what advice they may give us to allow us to structure a deal that is constitutional so we can go forward. No, we would not be able to go forward until we understand what the deal is.
So you would not be, that would be, if I may, Mr. Chair, in any contract or agreement, that would be some of the conditions that you would build into it?
Representative Guttenberg, to the chair, yes.
And then what happens at that point when we can't give you the fiscal certainty that you've been looking for?
Representative Guttenberg, to the chair, I believe we will get advice from the court as to how to make it constitutional. We'll have to go back to the court to try to work that issue out and resolve it. However, that's under the backdrop that we believe the Constitution of Alaska allows that to occur, and are ready to go forward and spend money while that constitutional challenge is going on.
Thank you. In answer to Representative Guttenberg's question, I have some countries mentioned here. In fact, I have 40. And I'm not going to read all 40, but I'm going to read about every fifth to tenth country. Albania, Cambodia, Equatorial Guinea, Indonesia, Jordan, Mauritania, Nigeria, Trinidad and Tobago, and ending in Zambia. I'm not in the list. I'm not seeing any European countries that I'm familiar with. There are some African countries I'm familiar with, and there are some decent names on here that I think are fairly trustworthy, but none that I think are equivalent to a U.S. or an Alaskan operation. And that was not for you, Mr. Massey, but he did ask the question, and I did ask the question myself, and I thought it would be appropriate to give him the answer that I had. Representative Roses has a question.
I don't know if it's more of a question than a comment. I mean, I want to continue pursuing this, you know, fiscal uncertainty issue, because that's obviously the biggest hang-up. I mean, the other area you talked about was making this contract an objective-based contract, and I would like to pursue that a little bit more in a few minutes, but just to continue with the fiscal certainty. Having been in business myself for about 35 years, one of the things that I learned early on when I was trying to build a business on a piece of property that I leased was that there wasn't a bank in the state that would loan me one penny to build my business unless the lease exceeded the life of the loan by a minimum of 5 years. So if I needed a 15-year loan, I needed a guaranteed 20-year lease. If I had a 25-year loan, I needed a 30-year lease. And that's sort of what I think I hear you saying, sir, is that if we're going to go out and put financiers together to fund this project, because I heard you say, even with the resources that ExxonMobil has, that this wasn't a project that you felt your company would be willing to undertake by yourself. So if you have to go out and get financial backing to do this, I would assume that those financial backers are going to want some sort of the same kind of guarantee that the life of the loan would at least have some physical certainty to it in excess of the life of the loan. Is that what I hear you saying in different terms?
Representative Roses, through the chair, they will obviously look at the deal that we've got to make their own assessment to whether it's commercially viable. But on a deal of this magnitude, they're going to require the full backing of ExxonMobil. And we're, you know, that we are going to pay for this, whether the gas flows or not. And I mean, that has to be one of the things you look at in terms of who has the financial strength to provide that backing.
Please. And again, I've already prefaced it saying I wasn't here last year for the discussion, but at any point in time during those discussions, was there consideration given to an equity split in terms of the volume of the gas?
Representative Roses, through the chair, that's exactly what we did for the majority of the take. The state took their royalty gas, and they took their tax gas, and they were responsible for that, and received the benefits from the sale of that gas. So that's how we organized the bulk of the state revenue was associated with the gas that came along with it, and any liquids and so forth that went down the pipe.
And you inked your name on that agreement?
Representative Gatto, we were ready to ink our name on the agreement.
So let me just take a cue from Representative Roses. If we look today at the value of the gas, almost $8, and the tax, the 22.5%, and the royalty, and figured out that that equaled 25% of the value of the gas, and said, tell you what, why don't we become a one-quarter, three-quarter partner? That's as simple a contract as anyone could come up with. And it would end taxes, it would end all the uncertainty, except for the price, but then we would all suffer equally or be blessed equally. Would that be something that Exxon would consider?
Representative Gatto, where do we sign?
I just happen to have.
But we're done.
I don't know if it's 25 or, the last deal that we cut was around 20. And we need to look at that in terms of the cost has gone up and so forth. But the concept that you are outlining is a concept that will allow us to work together to minimize the risk associated with the project. Would wholly support having a further dialogue around that particular issue.
And Representative Roses has
Please,
a question.
I'd like to clarify, because I want to make sure that nobody misunderstood what I said. At no point in time did I say I thought we ought to own 25, 30, or 40% of the pipeline. What I said was the physical certainty of what happens downstream, that the way that you would accomplish that or potentially could accomplish that to say, in lieu of taxes and in lieu of this, in lieu of that, we're going to take a certain percentage of the volume that goes through that gas, and we get the money off of that. And that nowhere in there was I talking about sharing in the expense of building the pipeline. Just in lieu of taxes, taking a percentage of the volume was. So I just wanted to make that clear for the record that I did not advocate partial ownership at this point in time.
And Representative Roses, I think I might add that the tariff is an extremely important part of the value of the gas. And I think we would want to own a piece of the pipeline. We would borrow money to own a piece of the pipeline, because that is the consistent income combined with the variable income depending on the price of gas. And I think that takes a little bit of the wiggle out of it. You would like that. We would like that. And now Representative Guttenberg has a question.
On the same point, the GNE administration is proposing to put $500 million into this process. What is ExxonMobil's position on that? Are you looking to that to take advantage of that, or do you think that's not necessary?
Representative Guttenberg, through the chair, I believe the changes that the last committee made in terms of the $500 million became a bid variable rather than, it was a requirement to participate in that, was a good change, because then it allows individual applicants to propose, how they would like to use the $500 million. And that change is very consistent with what I am trying to describe as the way to go forward. Make these things less prescriptive. Let the applicants describe, how they would want to use, or propose to cover the different commercial viability things that need to be addressed. The $500 million is not a big issue for us. We would like to see the state participate in the project because we think it helps alignment. But if you put money in the project, our view is you ought to be a participant in the project. If you want to put money in, get some value from that and be an owner. We'd like to have you as an owner in the project. It puts us together. It aligns us together to try to execute the project. So in our view, if you're going to put money in it, it ought to be directed at getting it in an ownership position in the project.
And I need to mention that even if this Cinderella plan were to materialize, the issue of a zero tax is still something that enables the state in 10 years, 5 years, 25 years to say, we'd like to begin a tax on gas. And that pretty well goes against the idea of, why don't we just share the resource? We want this percent, everyone else gets all the other percents, but we get this percent. And we don't tax production, we don't tax real estate, we don't tax. That is our tax. Can we, and I wondered about whether or not when you start out with a zero tax, can you guarantee it will be zero for the life of the project? And I'm suspicious that from what I heard yesterday in Senate Judiciary, there was a long conversation about the 10 years of certainty, and there were differing opinions from the state as to whether or not we could do that. I was more comfortable with the latter decision, which said we could, because there were some references to the U.S. Constitution and the state constitution and the meaning of very specific words, which are only there for a reason. For without those words, it would be an easy description of what the law was. But with those words, it meant there was an exception.
Right.
So that's, you know, it's just a golden opportunity for us to chat about possibilities. And I'm hopeful that, you know, in your presentation, there's facts and then gives us an opportunity to discuss what we can do with the facts. But so far, I appreciate your presentation. I always like to hear it, and I think you're a very good presenter. So please,
thank you.
Go ahead.
Okay. Development of a predictable and durable fiscal framework means that the terms agreed between the producers and the state recognize the magnitude and the risk associated with the project, balance state and producer needs, and provide for the calculation of state take in a transparent and predictable manner. Nothing can be more transparent and predictable than you get a certain percentage of the gas. That's pretty transparent and predictable.
I was thinking half.
Maybe you started too low. AGIA should allow market participants to put forward their best proposal on what is required to make the project viable, thereby creating a competitive process that will allow the state the opportunity to consider those proposals that have the best chance of actually delivering on the promise of an Alaska gas pipeline. I'd like to now give some specific feedback on AGIA, which is based on the conclusions and principles I've mentioned. I will also outline some additional thoughts on how AGIA should be modified to provide the best chance of a successful result. For example, alignment between the state and the leaseholders is essential to a basin opening project of this magnitude. Therefore, establishing the right approach going forward is the most important activity for the project at this time. It is important that AGIA bring together the upstream and the midstream and provide for an integrated proposal. Let me expand on this point. The upstream and midstream at some point will have to come together. The reason is simple. The upstream pays for the midstream. And when I say upstream, I mean the revenue generated from the sale of gas and liquids from the pipeline project. To be able to calculate the revenue from the upstream, we must have clarity on the taxes and the royalty from our oil and gas operations, and the taxes and royalties must be set at a level that makes the project viable. In order to ensure a viable project from the outset, we believe that this must be done at the beginning. At a minimum, any proposal should demonstrate how a successful open season would be achieved. As I discussed previously with regard to the upstream terms, the proposed upstream inducements would require significant modification to ensure a commercially viable project is obtained. It would be better to leave this issue open for now and allow an applicant to make a proposal to address those terms. AGIA also prescribes activities that must be completed within a specific time frame or date certain. Setting arbitrary target dates is not consistent with good management practices. Further milestones are not necessary if the project is commercially viable. The producers will progress the project at the maximum prudent pace, consistent with industry-proven gate process for project development. In general, AGIA lacks specifics on other key fiscal terms and requirements. To address these gaps, AGIA gives commissioners broad authority to adopt additional requirements and establish regulations. Not knowing their these requirements now creates significant uncertainty. Finally, because of the complexity and risk associated with the project, the parties must have an efficient and impartial means of handling disagreements when they arise. We believe project-related agreements should provide for binding neutral arbitration as the mechanism for resolving disputes. Binding neutral arbitration is widely utilized in the U.S. and international commercial agreements and is not a new concept within the state of Alaska. Arbitration is the method used to resolve disputes under the state's royalty settlement agreements. In Alaska, and in addition, Alaska courts have recognized a strong public policy in favor of arbitration.
Mr. Massey, I've been exposed to binding arbitration in the past with contracts with municipal departments, and they've been fairly successful, but they have not been quick. In a project labor agreement, is that you were talking about theirs where we would have binding arbitration as far as violations of the contract?
Representative Gatto, binding neutral arbitration is the dispute mechanism we would propose for the relationship between the producers and the state. That's how we would resolve disagreements amongst ourselves.
And I know there's an arbitration society where each side picks an arbitrator, the two pick a third arbitrator, and that is, then they make a decision. Is that the same one that you're considering?
Representative Gatto, yes.
Thank you. Representative Guttenberg, question?
I know how this currently the state and the producers have worked things out, but amongst the producers currently on the slope between you and the other two, do you have binding arbitration between yourselves, or what do you use to deal with these problems?
Representative Guttenberg, through the chair, our agreements govern how we make decisions, and that relates into, you know, voting and so forth to make decisions. We've not really had a dispute that we've had to take to court or to arbitration. We've handled that through the normal governance. The parties have agreed that we need to work toward arbitration if we have a major disagreement amongst ourselves.
So in more than 30 years, you've worked everything out internally.
Representative Guttenberg, we have, yes.
Mr. Massey, I can't help myself on this one. I'm going to go back a couple of decades to the Exxon Valdez. What kind of arbitration was in existence at that time? Was that binding arbitration or just go to a jury or?
Representative Gatto, I think Valdez has been handled through the courts.
So that's jury,
yeah,
situation.
Jury, judge.
It has certainly taken a lifetime.
Taken a very long time.
And we don't need or want or wish for the same kind of arbitration rules as a jury then. So binding arbitration is a significant shortcut.
Representative Gatto, we believe it is. It is a more efficient process for handling disputes.
Okay, thank you.
We also note that the House Oil and Gas Committee and the Senate Resource Committee made a number of amendments to AGIA. While substantial work needs to be done to make AGIA truly objective, several of the proposed changes moved in the right direction, including making the state's entire capital contribution a bid bearable, which we already discussed. Beefing up evaluation criteria, recognizing the need to include terms in a contract, and requiring legislative approval of any license award. All of those changes we believe were in the right direction. Unfortunately, steps were also taken that will likely limit the number of potential bidders by eliminating any confidentiality protection for a licensee's proprietary and trade secret data and imposing new prescriptive terms, such as requiring any bidder to forego its legal rights to challenge an improper award. What we have at this stage is an AGIA bill that remains too prescriptive to solicit the quality market-based bid necessary to move the project forward. In closing, I'd like to reiterate that ExxonMobil is committed to moving the gas pipeline project forward. Our company possesses the financial strength and project experience required to make this project a success. We are ready to work with the administration and legislature to establish a framework that recognizes the integrated nature of the project and mitigates the risk I've discussed to allow the project to progress. We would suggest the GEA be amended to include a broad, objective-driven framework that sets out what the state wants to achieve. The GEA should allow each applicant to propose how best to meet those objectives and identify what is required from the state to advance the project. This process will secure more viable applications, create more competition, and afford the state the opportunity to secure the most value. We are ready to participate in a competitive, open, and transparent process under the approach I've outlined. Thank you for your attention and the opportunity to address this important topic today, and I look forward to any other questions you may
have.
There'll
be a few. Representative Roses.
Thank you very much. With a little latitude, I'd like to pursue the objective-driven concept that you brought up, because I heard you mention it about five times in your presentation. I just made a quick note of the 20 criteria that's going to be required of the licensee and start to go through these, and I'm going to just sort of hit them very quickly. One is an application process. Well, that's pretty objective, so I don't think that's an issue. That you must submit a detailed project. I don't see that as an issue. That you have to follow FERC guidelines. Well, we don't have control over that either. If it is an RCA, if it's an in-state, that you have to follow the appropriate guidelines of RCA, is that a non-objective issue?
We believe the project's going to be, Representative Roses through the chair, we believe the project will be regulated by FERC, and RCA will not have a role in the project.
So, and I'm obviously very quickly summarizing these points. The fifth is access to market capacity. Is the way that's defined in this bill, is that an issue in terms of your objective-driven document?
Explain that one again.
Well, item number five, what it says. Find the exact wording there. Item number five says, that's the section of the bill that talks about after the first binding open season, they have to have a commit to assess the market demand for additional pipeline capacity at least every 2 years through public non-binding solicitation or similar means. Is that an issue?
Representative,
or objectivity?
Representative Roses, I would leave that one open to the applicant to decide how they're going to assess market capacity. You may find, the applicant can come up with a way to do that a bit better than just mandating at least every 2 years.
Okay, so if I may.
Please, I'm going to just add one thing before you continue on. If indeed Exxon had committed its gas, and we're going to deal with the question of rolled-in rates and incremental rates, I think the question with number five is, would Exxon object to recognizing that every 2 years we're going to look at demand and capacity and ability to push gas and be willing to make some adjustments, even if the adjustments might cost more money, might cost less money, but at least be willing to, and then it might go to arbitration. I don't know, but I think that's the question.
Representative Gatto, can you help me with your question again?
Yeah.
What would you like me to address?
Question five is talking about increasing pipeline capacity. And that is, so we're talking compression, we're talking looping, we're talking money. And initially, I think in the first 2 years, if we add compression and the prices go down, there's probably no objection, unless we're saturating the downstream market and driving prices down. Then we have a new question. And if we get to looping, then probably everybody's costs go up, but it depends again on the market downstream whether the prices are high. So if I'm correct then, would you, as Exxon or any of the pipeline builders, be willing to say every 2 years we need to look at the cost and the demand and make an adjustment so that we can produce as much gas as is reasonable under the circumstances, which to me seemed like an easy one if you know the cost and you know the price?
Representative Gatto, pipelines get expanded all the time. Pipeline companies work with potential suppliers and identify the potential to expand. work with the initial shippers in terms of how that expansion is going to be done, how it's going to be paid for. You know, the business community, the market know how to do these things. If for some reason someone feels like you know, they're not being treated fairly in that process, FERC will regulate those expansions. All parties can go to FERC. It doesn't really matter what we write in here. FERC is going to make the decision as to, you know, how that should be dealt with. I believe the issue of how expansions are going to be handled, what sort of terms are, you know, is a party willing to commit to, should be left open for an applicant to provide in their proposal. And then the state can look at those in the scheme of the applicant's total proposal that they're giving to the state. So we would remove that sort of prescription and leave it open.
Okay. I'm interrupted because it looks like Representative Seaton is on point here.
Yeah, I'm just trying to get to the answer to number five. So Exxon would not be willing to have at least every 2 years through public non-binding or a similar means an assessment of the, if there's other people that want to ship gas down the pipeline, you would oppose having that in as just one of the terms of that you would commit if you were the pipeline operator to assessing every 2 years through some public means?
Representative Seaton, through the chair, please don't misinterpret what I said. I said I would make that a variable for the applicant to decide. They may come up with a better approach. We may be willing to do it every month.
This just says at least every 2 years.
Okay, but if you get somebody that agrees to do it every month.
That's fine. That would qualify.
That would qualify.
Maybe you'd like that better than somebody that says they're going to do it every 2 years. Leave it open for the applicant to decide how they would like to propose that. You may find that you come up with a better solution than what's written there. That is what I'm proposing. I'm not saying we are against at least every 2 years or not. You just leave it open and let the applicant describe how they're going to do it. You may find something better.
Representative Rose,
if I may, and I'm going through these to try to determine which of these would be objective driven and which wouldn't be, and to me, specifying that at least every 2 years is objective driven, whether the 2 years is the appropriate number or not is not where I'm trying to arrive. I mean, maybe it ought to be every 3 years, maybe it ought to be every 6 months, I don't know, but at least every 2 years would not prohibit anything less than 2 years, but it would require at least every 2 years. But I see that as, whether we agree with a number or not, would you agree that that is an objective driven statement?
I would say the broad objective, Representative Roses, I would say the objective for the state is to ensure that the pipe can be expanded. That is the objective the state should describe, and they should leave it to the applicants to describe what process they're going to put in place to make sure the pipe can be expanded. That seems like a detail to me in terms of going out and you know, searching the marketplace for when there might be an expansion that should be left up to an applicant to propose.
Okay. And if I may continue, number six, I think you just covered.
It's right there, because number five simply says agree to assess. And everyone would probably find it easy to say, okay, every 2 years I'll assess things. But now we get to number six.
So number six is the one that says you would commit to expand the proposed project in a reasonable engineering increments and commercially reasonable terms that encourage exploration and development of the gas resources. In other words, this is the expansion capability that's built into the market. So
right.
So what I hear you say is that you feel that would be, let's see if I can paraphrase what I think I heard you saying, correct me if I'm wrong. I think what I heard you say was that it would be in the best interest of anyone developing a pipeline or anyone trying to run the business of a pipeline to always build an expansion capability, and that so therefore you don't think that this is necessary to be a part of this piece of legislation.
Representative Roses, that's correct.
Okay. But then I'll go back to my other question. Would you consider that statement to be an objective-driven statement?
Representative Roses, no, I would not.
Okay, thank you. The next is where we're going to really get to some discussion, and that's number seven, which is commit to propose and support recovery of the mainline capacity expansion cost. Hence, we're talking about the roll-in cost not to exceed 15% above the initial maximum recourse from North Slope to the proposed downstream mainstream project terminus. Would you consider that to be an objective-driven statement?
Representative Roses, no, I would not.
And how would that have to be structured in a way that you and your company would feel that it was objective-driven? Or is the only way you're going to feel that's important is if it's not in it at all?
Obviously, Representative Roses, through the chair, it's very important for the state to understand how each applicant will propose to deal with expansions. And because the state views that if the pipe can't be expanded, then folks won't come up here and explore for gas. And, you know, in some respects, I'm in that same camp. Even though I would be an owner in the pipeline, that's a separate affiliate. We have to keep it separate and so forth. I'm on the upstream side. I find gas and produce gas. That's what I do. So, you know, we want the ability to go and explore for gas and know that we can get access to the pipe as well. We have confidence that the business community knows how to do these things. However, given the uncomfort that the state has with it, they should require every applicant to propose how they're going to ensure the state that it will be expanded. And rather than, if you will, describing it in that detail, let the applicant describe in detail how they would propose doing it, is the way we would approach it.
Sure. Go to Representative Guttenberg.
I understand you've compartmentalized your businesses a little bit, but don't you think it is the state's inherent interest to bring in explorers and new producers, and in order to do that, both diversifying the North Slope, and the way to do that is to have a consistent, reliable, which is what you've been looking for, and you talk about access to expansion, and having every 2 years part of that. Don't you think that's a reasonable thing for the state to ask and an expectation to have in anybody putting a contract forward for the state's interests?
Representative Guttenberg, through the chair, you know, I didn't want to imply that was unreasonable. And please don't misinterpret what I've said. I'm not implying that is unreasonable. I'm implying that, or indicating that, our preference would be for the applicant to describe how they're going to propose to you to ensure that if there's gas there, you know, it will get due consideration. I think it's also important to understand when it comes to expansion that, you know, under the Alaska Natural Gas Pipeline Act, Congress struck what it determined was the proper balance between encouraging investment by those willing to commit to pay for initial capacity and encouraging exploration by providing an opportunity for future access to the pipeline. And because of this, the unique nature of the gas pipeline project, and it's unique in the standpoint that it's a basin opening project which requires great alignment between the state and the producers, and most likely the producers are going to be the one that built project. In our view, that's the way it's going to occur because we believe that's the maximum benefit to the state. That there is this perception of an inherent conflict, but being the producers on both sides of that. And what
there is,
you know, that's right, and I understand that. And what Congress did is they gave FERC unprecedented policies to enable a FERC mandated expansion to benefit explorers. So in some respects, this issue has been dealt with, and it's been dealt with in the right agency that regulates these and oversees these pipelines. They're the ones that are going to make sure, you know, explorers get a fair shot at the access.
And recognizing that for the state, having explorers look for gas gives us some life for our oil. We're very hopeful we can extend the life of the TAPS line, and it won't happen unless we can find additional supplies. We can pray for ANWR, we can pray for NPR, but finding oil is really beneficial to us. So the state is interested in expansion, You're telling us that the FERC mandates it, and I'm not sure they mandate it, but they're the one that makes the decision. That's the way you read it?
Representative Gatto, you will not have any trouble if we get a gas pipeline going, getting explorers to go look for gas. We already have a big gap to fill the pipeline. Plus, we know there's going to be the opportunity to expand the pipe. There will be no problem with people coming up here trying to find gas. You will find us being part of that effort. Under the ANCPA and the FERC approved, what they allowed FERC to do, it's unprecedented, but it gives them the right to mandate an expansion to benefit explorers. They have the right to take that case up and decide whether it should be, you know, they should mandate that the pipe be expanded.
I'm going to get back to Representative Roses, but I wanted to clear the questions, and then we can go on to the next point.
That's fine.
So, did you have another question?
Well, on that, I'm looking at FERC's ruling, and it talks about open expansion, and I'll give you the open season for expansion. In order to promote competition and open access to the project, may require design changes to ensure that all those willing to sign long term. But aren't you guys in court trying to prevent FERC from having the ability to demand design changes to meet open seasons?
Representative Guttenberg, through the chair, ANCPA was put in place in 2004. That's the Natural Gas Pipeline Act. Mm-hmm. In that act, there were things that put in place, expedited regulatory review, the establishment of the federal coordinator, and required FERC to develop open season regulations. In those open season regulations, they also have the ability to mandate an expansion. And all of that is in place. The issue that is currently in court is the ability for FERC to mandate a design change. So when we go forward with the pipeline application to FERC, after we've gone through the open season, we've identified the design, we're maybe $400 million and $500 million into it at that particular point in time. We go to FERC. At the very end of that process, someone could come in and ask for a design change. We may have $1 billion in it and have to go back and start over. Mm-hmm. We would like some clarity around that issue, and that's why we're going to court. We have no problem with the FERC mandated expansion. So if the design change can't be done, in the first project, then it should be the first expansion that we do after the project's up and running, rather than right when we're in the middle of the process having to make a change, which could cost us all, and we're all going to pay for that. That is the issue we're challenging, nothing else.
So, sorry, Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What I'd like to do is just explain to me exactly, if all of these things are going to happen, why do you object to having that in there then, if all that's going to happen anyway? I hate to say it like this, but what's the big deal? That's what we're trying to get at. Why is it so much of a big deal if you know that's going to happen anyway? Why do you care?
Representative Wilson, through the chair, which particular piece are you talking about?
The commitment to expand and at least every 2 years. And you said, well, couldn't someone say, well, I'd rather have it come up every month or whatever. But why is that a big deal for you? I mean, there must be a reason. If you say it's all going to happen and that's all going to fall into place and FERC's going to say this and you'll come explore and all that's going to happen, then what's the difference?
Representative Wilson, what I'm suggesting is that you allow applicants to propose how they intend to deal with the expansions rather than describing it here in legislation.
Go ahead.
Can't they do that? I mean, couldn't you do that anyway? I mean, here it says commit to expand. Well, couldn't you say, well, we're going to commit to expand, and we're going to do it here and here and here and here? Can't you do that anyway?
Representative Wilson, I'm not sure I'm following your question. We're just talking about what should be in legislation and what should be left for the applicants to propose. And I'm just, and what I'm suggesting is that you describe how your requirement, which is explorers need to have access to the pipe. You need to know it needs to be expanded. Let the applicants propose how they're going to deliver that for the state.
Okay, I guess what I'm saying is that no matter what is said here, you're going to say the same thing. And I kind of want you to say something different. You know, because I guess I can't get through to you. So.
Let me see if I can help. I understand.
Representative Rose.
If I may, thank you. I think what I heard you say was that it would be in the state's best interest if you weren't as prescriptive in here in terms of it would be a roll-in rate and would be a maximum of 15%, and you would build in the discussion, you would outline in your proposal exactly what you would do about expansion. And what I'm paraphrasing, but what I think I heard you say was it would be in the state's best interest if you made that more of a competitive part of the bidding process as opposed to being prescriptive in the way you outline it. Is that what I heard you say?
Representative Roses, I wish I could have said it as well as you did. Thank you.
So the answer was yes?
Yes.
Okay. Well, he was on page 6, number 5, and after the first finding.
7.
7? Oh,
page
sorry.
6, item number 7.
Okay. Sorry.
And I was at 5 and 6.
Because I was trying to back up to the original word where it was commit to assess the market. And I thought you had said, well, let's leave that up to the person who bids. And I thought, it's not much of a commitment to assess. Good grief, we could do that here and say we've done it. And then the next one after that was number 6, which was then commit to expand, and it had points A and B before it got to number 7. That was a little more complex, but I believe Representative Wilson was talking about number 6 and said you had objected to that, which seemed easy to simply allow because all it was an assessment. And am I correct, Representative Wilson?
I was talking about both 5 and 6.
All right. So I don't know if we've resolved number 6, but Representative Roses, I'm sure, has got a few more to cover here.
Yes, I do. Thank you very much. I appreciate the latitude because I'm really trying to drill down as to what this objective-driven document would look like. One thing I did hear you discuss in item number 7, Mr. Massey, was the expansion, but what I didn't hear you comment on was the roll-in rates, nor did I hear you comment on the 15% maximum increase farther down the line when expansion capability occurs. Would you give me a little bit of your take on that wording in this document, whether or not you think that is an encumbrance to someone submitting a bid?
Yes. Representative Roses, through the chair, you know, the issue of how potential future shippers may access initial capacity and future expansion capacity, if needed, should be administered by FERC for all elements of the project in the United States. For example, shippers, being the producers, should not be required to subsidize other expansion gas holders at 115% of the initial maximum rates due to mandated roll-in of expansion costs. For example, the 15% increase could increase my FT commitment by 30 to 50 cents per MBTU on gas shipped. This is an increase of $500-800 million a year on the initial shippers. You could consider this a subsidy to the expansion shipper. And we are not in the process, you know, in the business of subsidizing our competitors. It's too high of a risk to take. I recognize that amendments in place now allow shippers to protest roll-in rates at FERC. So that has been done in the last committee. But the current form of GS still requires the pipeline company to propose roll-in rates. And we would suggest you allow the pipeline flexibility in deciding what is necessary to achieve an acceptable expansion.
Let me interrupt you here, if I may. You actually might be the primary beneficiary of a rolled-in rate if the additional gas is yours and cause everyone else to pay the additional cost along with you. So there are some advantages to the person who has the the new gas lines. Number two was, initially, rolled-in rates drop everybody's price. Compression is cheaper than pipe until we reach that end. So if indeed we're going to pay up to 15% of an increase, we might actually begin by paying 5% to 10% of a decrease and then back up to zero before we pay the 15% increase. I know it's not possible to calculate ahead of time, but I believe the 15% cap was put there simply to say, understandably, you don't want to be subsidizing the new producers with your gas. I don't blame you a bit there. It's like paying more rent because you've got some neighbors moving in. But there is a reduction initially, and I'm going to suggest that no one is going to object to the reduction, although they might object to the 15% cap. With regard to Exxon's position, since I'm expecting Exxon to discover quite a bit of the new gas, is it not to your advantage to incorporate these rules that say roll-in rates are really good things?
Representative Gatto, we would propose removing any sort of mandates and let the business resolve it at the time.
So incremental rates are preferable?
Incremental rates are rolled-in rates. It needs to be acceptable to the parties involved in this project. Everyone will have made such a huge commitment in terms of trying to make this project happen, that establishing mandates that could potentially harm their economics in the future just won't work. The parties have got to be able to have the flexibility to come together without one party having more leverage than the other and see if they can't come to a business arrangement. And if they can't, then there's always FERC to resolve the issue. So, you know, our suggestion is don't mandate these sorts of things. Let the applicant propose how they deal with it.
Okay. Let me just tell you what the plan is here. It's 20-3. I know we're going to go beyond 3, and I'm going to ask everyone to take a break, go get some fresh water, go get whatever we want to get, use the restroom, and talk to each other, and then come back by 3. So if breaking right now is good, or did you want to get another point in and break in 5 minutes, I'm going to leave that decision up to you since you're our guest.
Representative Gatto, I'm good to go. However you want to do it. However you want to do it.
Okay.
I can take a break or I'm good to go.
Let's take a break starting right now. I'm going to recess.
And 5 minutes. Just 5 minutes.
5 minutes?
We got Hess at 3:30.
No, you're not going to.
5 minute break?
Yeah.
Sure, 5 minutes. Just let me know.
There's nothing up there.
I'm okay with a 5 minute break, but that's hardly enough time.
Sure, not plentiful.
And we'll continue with Mr. Massey's presentation.
I'm done presented and ready to answer questions.
You've hit the end of the sheets?
Yes, sir.
I think we're on number 8.
Whatever.
Thank you very much.
Representative Kawasaki, did you have a question?
No.
No. Representative Wilson?
I would like a copy of the notes.
Mr. Massey, do you have your notes in a form that can be copied and distributed?
Representative Gatto, I made some handwritten remarks on those. I'll go back and
erase
clean those up and make sure you get a copy.
Appreciate that. Representative Seaton.
Thank you. I just want to get a little clarification here. On number 6, relates to several of these things, you know, number 6 is really just committing to expand the proposed project at reasonable engineering increments. And I suspect you don't, but maybe you do, but I suspect you do not object to the reasonable incremental or reasonable engineering increment section of that, or on commercial reasonable terms. I suspect that you don't object to those provisions, but if you do, I'd like to get clarity on that. And so I think what I was hearing was your objection was that you want the expansion to be evaluated. You would rather have that as a proposal to be evaluated coming from you without this being a criteria. However, if we look back on page 11 at the evaluation criteria, these are going to be evaluated under, like number three, the ability of the applicant, or let's see, number four, the initial design capacity of the applicant's project and the extent to which the design can accommodate low-cost expansion. So as I understand it, the evaluation criteria are going to allow for the flexibility as long as you have this commitment, you know, that the other one, number five, at least every 2 years. If you said you were going to do it every month or every 2 months, that would be evaluated in the expansion criteria, and so it is evaluated. Or under this one, you're committing to do expansions on reasonable engineering increments. And whatever proposals you would come forward with, that would be evaluated. So I'm trying to figure out why setting the minimums that the state wants constrains you from making a better offer that will be evaluated under these six different criteria between projects.
Representative Seaton, through the chair. What we're proposing is a way for to modify GIA or amend the GIA to make it work is to remove the prescription, describe your broad objectives, let the applicants propose how they intend to meet your broad objective. The evaluation criteria is there. Obviously, you will look at what the applicant is saying in terms of how they intend to provide for expansions. And then you can make your judgment based upon, you know, what the different applicants propose.
So the follow-up.
Go ahead.
So if the state wants to reassess every 2 years, and we don't tell you that, and so you put a proposal in that says every 3 years, so you get thrown out. And we say, no, this isn't going to do the state what we want to do, because we haven't told you that the minimum is that we want you to reevaluate or reassess every 2 years. Is that the kind of a process? I mean, these are just minimums in these criteria as I'm reading them, and then they'll be evaluated for what more benefit that you bring other than these minimums. So are you saying that you don't want us to specify the minimums and then downgrade your project if you propose something that didn't meet our preconceived minimums that we didn't tell you about, but you're willing to have the project downgraded because we didn't tell you what our minimums are?
Representative Seaton, through the chair, the fact that some of these must-haves or minimums, as you described, are laid out here, gives us an indication of what you would like to see. And it's difficult to take each individual one and look at it in isolation. What we would propose you do is that if someone is uncomfortable with two and they propose three, but they also propose a 30% rolled in, then because you have a minimum of two, then you lose the flexibility of accepting what they give you in the roll in. So it's difficult to get prescriptive on individual items. You may be foreclosing an opportunity to consider something that's much more valuable to you in another area with what you've laid out here. So what we're trying to describe is thanks for sharing this with us. We understand what you're trying to achieve, and if we want to win the bid, then we need to try to deliver what you've suggested, and we're going to try to win. But just because you've set out specific criteria, then you may disregard my bid if I'm only comfortable doing it every 3 years, but I provide you something much more valuable in another area that's much better than your must-have. So that's what I'm trying to describe is is the way we would propose going forward, is give yourself the flexibility to take something maybe that's not quite as important to you because you get something much better over here.
So, and just to follow up, so, but you don't see anything in here that says that if you wanted to propose that you're going to go 30% enrolled in rates. I mean, this doesn't prevent you from doing that and doesn't prevent the criteria, the evaluation criteria for giving you credit on that. You're only, what you're saying is, oh, well, if you only wanted to do it every 10 years, and we're saying that's not acceptable because that's not going to provide for the explorers, you don't want us to say that. You want us to balance, it's going to be a private line for you only, and there will only be a 10-year reassessment of needs, and you want us to not tell you up front that we're going to reject that? Is that...
Yeah, Representative Seaton, through the chair, we're talking about hypotheticals.
Yeah, sure.
You know, we're talking about hypotheticals, and that gets, it gets very difficult. 2 to 10, that's a long change. You know, I can understand maybe you would reject a bid if we said we were only going to assess the market every 10 years. I mean, obviously, that would not be something that we would propose. And the hypothetical I threw out is 3, is don't interpret that as being what we think is the right answer. It's just a hypothetical. As to describing why a prescriptive approach, you know, may not work for you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
As it stands now, there is no AGIA on the books. It's simply a proposal in a bill that has not yet been approved. I don't think there's anything that would prevent Exxon from taking a look at what's in AGIA, putting in a proposal the things they like, not putting in the proposal the things they dislike, and going to the governor's office and saying, you know, if you can live with this, we can live with this. Is that something that you'd be at least willing to entertain? Or do you insist on waiting until AGIA passes and then be under the confines of saying these are must-haves?
Representative Gatto, if the administration was willing to seriously consider and sit down and discuss what is necessary for a project to go forward, we'd obviously entertain that. No question. But the administration has decided this is the process they're going to use, a competitive, open, transparent process, and we have to work within the process that the administration and the legislature ultimately agree upon. We're happy in doing that if AGIA is modified such that we're allowed and able to make a conforming bid. And the way AGIA is written today, you know, we can't, because it doesn't result in a commercially viable project.
And I believe that is the reason Representative Roses is going through it number by number until we reach number 20 and then go on to the rest of the bill to see what is the barrier in any one proposal. And then I'm sure he and the rest of this committee would be willing to at least investigate with the governor's office the best way to proceed. If the governor's office says, I'm sorry, it's these 20 or nothing, or we'll see how it progresses through the committee process. But if I were a big company, I'd say, listen, I know what's coming down the pike. This is what's coming down the pike. If I don't like it, maybe I should just beat every other horse by leaving early and running my race around the track and arriving at the governor's office with a document that's just as big, or wait, much bigger, and saying, this is Exxon's proposal. Take it or leave it. Or tell me what you disagree with. Wouldn't that be a rational and reasonable approach for a company that may not be willing to agree to all of these terms, but would agree to the bulk of them and maybe some adjustments?
Representative Gatto, you know, I'd answer, you know, this, the same, is that if the administration was willing to consider a proposal, obviously we would do that. That's not the approach that they've taken.
Representative Roses?
Thank you. I realize looking at each one of these individually in isolation doesn't necessarily allow the ability to tie them together, but in terms of looking at each phase of this and being able to get some some feedback and comment, and then other questions being generated as results helps me understand each aspect of it, and then also in terms of where I think your presentation was going. So I appreciate the difficulty of being able to necessarily isolate each of these items, and I appreciate the chair's willingness to let me pursue this. So the next item that you have on here, and again, I'm trying to get back to whether or not you consider these to be objective-driven criteria. It's the old math teacher in me, you know. And number eight, state how the applicant proposes to deal with North Slope Gas Treatment Plant, regardless of whether such a plan is part of the applicant's proposal. What's your response to that one? Is that an objective-driven criteria?
Representative Roses, through the chair, the gas treatment plant has to be dealt with and should be part of an applicant's proposal in terms of how they're going to treat the gas. So we would say that's part of the project. It's dealt with when the applicant has to put forward what their project scope is and what they intend to do with it. There are some things in 8 where it talks about, you know, how you're going to value existing facilities on the North Slope and so forth for rate-making purposes, have to use the net book value. Those sort of things, you know, should be left up to an applicant to decide, you know, how they propose including the existing facilities into the project base.
Okay, so if I may, to the chair. So what I heard you say then is that it's, you understand the fact that the gas treatment plant part that's in here is an integral part of the process, but where you have the concern in this particular item has to do with establishing the rate and the net book value at the treatment plant. That's the concern.
Representative, yes, that's correct.
Okay. And in your opinion, sir, what type of scenario would make that the most competitive fix to this piece of legislation?
Representative Roses, through the chair, rather than describing the gas treatment plant at net, using own assets as part of the net book value, you leave it up to the applicant to decide how those are going to be rolled into the rate base for the project. Don't mandate how that should be done.
Representative Roses.
So item number 9 would be proposed a percentage and a dollar amount to be specified in the license. Is that an issue?
Representative Roses, you know, the last committee made the state contribution a variable in the analysis. It would be our recommendation that you remove that entirely and let the applicant propose what they need. Do they need a contribution or not? Would they like to see, you know, for example, some ownership from the state in the project? So I would leave that entirely up to the applicant to decide what's necessary to make the project go.
Would you define, if you were to change just the wording, would you say the applicant shall determine the extent to which the state may contribute a percentage of the project cost?
Representative Gatto, that would be reasonable.
So that you could take 100 or you could take 70?
Take none.
Or none. Yeah. In which case, we would be the project manager, the project owner, the pipe owner. We don't have the $20 billion, at least.
The risk.
Good point. Representative Roses.
Thank you, sir. Number 10, commit to propose and support rates for the proposed project for a North Slope gas treatment plant, so on and so on. Is that part of what one would consider an objective-driven criteria?
Representative Roses, through the chair, obviously, you know, the applicant should propose how they intend to, you know, manage tariff and so forth. Mandating that it's 70% debt is not something that we would suggest be included in the bill. You should leave that open to the applicant to determine, you know, how they want to do the rate structure. That is too specific in our view.
Actually, it's not less than 70.
There may be some out there that can't do it unless it's 60. but they give you something else that you value. Therefore, you'd want to hear that.
And the point of it, I believe, the reason the administration wanted that one was to say the way to control the cost of the pipeline was to say if 70% is debt, then that is entitled to a 14% profit rate. The 30% that is not debt but equity can make 45%, but it's only 45% of the 30% instead of 45% of the 100%. And the goal is to keep the tariff at a place for all of the producers to a point where everyone's making good money. And the 70-30 ratio is there to reach that goal. I think the administration would be reluctant to compromise on that. And I'm going to ask you if that's the word has been used. Is that a deal killer?
Representative Gatto, in our last proposal, you know, we were going to shoot for 80% debt. Didn't know if we could get there or not, but that's something we were going to try to deliver. But you know, it gets back to the point of allowing applicants flexibility in determining how they intend to meet the state objectives. And by picking 70, you may miss an opportunity to get something that works better for you. So,
okay, as some backup for what I said, I'm going to ask the camera to focus in on this chart. Because
the camera talks.
Even if I have nervousness or anything like that. The black line shows the combination of Exxon, BP, and Mobil's ability to earn money outside of a pipeline construction. They're just very good at what they do. I congratulate you. The red line is if you own a pipeline, that's your rate of return. The black line is if you don't care about pipelines, you simply buy and sell oil, that's your rate of return. In every single instance, you're better off not building a pipeline. Now, not that other people are better off not building a pipeline. I think there are some pipeline companies that are pretty good at building pipelines. But it does show that your company and other companies represented here are not good at it. Is there some reason why you would want to own anything larger than 30% of the pipeline, since all it will do is reduce the rate of return to your shareholders? I'm trying to help your shareholders.
Representative Gatto, and I'm sure they appreciate that. You know, our principle here is that we want to own a percent of the pipe, percent of the project that matches our percent of the throughput, so that we are balanced. That mm-hmm. the amount of gas we have going through equals amount of pipe. It's important to understand on a basin opening project like this that the leaseholders and the original resource owner, which is the state, you know, have to be aligned before the project will go forward. And these basin opening projects are done by the leaseholders. You can go look anywhere around the world. That's who does them. And the reason is because there's such a significant risk mm-hmm. with these large infrastructure-type projects. The leaseholder is really the one that's going to benefit, if you will, from opening up the resource, and therefore, you know, they're willing to take the risk and have to because, you know, the risk is so great that, you know, that they need to manage it. And that's how they get done.
Representative Roses.
Thank you. I think we're down to number 11. 11 has to do with the management of cost overruns. Do you see that as being an objective-driven criteria?
Yes, I do.
Number 12 then has to do with committing to provide a minimum of 5 takeoff points, delivery points within the state.
Representative Roses, through the chair, that would be one I would leave open for the applicant to determine, you know, how they want to handle and propose access to the pipe for in-state deliveries. So I would leave that one open.
Well, I'm going to mention that that's a political problem, not a monetary one. The people in the state feel like the gas ought to at least be able to come to them, and the and we can't deliver it to them, but we can deliver takeoff points. That includes the addition of some manipulation in the pipe at that point to add a valve so that somebody can attach a smaller pipe and build a whole new pipeline for whatever the distance is required to reach the market. The pipeline comes right down Cushman Street, much easier. If it doesn't come any closer to Anchorage than Glen Allen, much harder. But all it's asking is for you to furnish a place, five places, where that could be done. And you envision that as something that you couldn't agree to?
Representative Gatto, I'm not saying we can agree or not. I'm saying I would make that part of the applicant's proposal, how they intend to handle access. So I'm not saying we would disagree with five or not. I'm saying I would make that part of the applicant's proposal as to how they handle in-state gas access.
Representative Roses.
Thank you. I want to continue on that a little bit because I want to go back to, you know, I keep referencing my own experiences in business, and one of the things that I did for a while in my life was a contractor. And I loved nothing more than bidding on jobs where I knew that they had things in there that couldn't possibly be done. Because if I was smart enough at going through that set of plans and find out where all the change orders were going to be, that's where I made my money. So I could very deliberately go out and bid very low on the project knowing they couldn't build it the way it was. Because now when I go back with that change order, that's where I get to make my money. And that's what I think, if I'm good at picking those out, those change orders is what makes the difference on whether or not you turn a profit or whether you don't. And so I see from the state's perspective, if we think at some point in time in the future we need five takeoff points and we don't specify that, then if we come to, assuming let's say Exxon were the bid winner and you're building this pipeline and we say, oh, by the way, we need five takeoff points, if that isn't specified in the project to begin with, would that at not at some point in time say, well, wait a minute, we can do that, but that wasn't part of the original bid, that's going to cost you a little bit. And unfortunately, a little bit in a $30 billion project is really not a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah, Representative Roses, through the chair, we're not talking about a lot of money here, you know, an offtake point. We're not talking about money here. So if you absolutely have to have five, then you probably need to write down you have to have five. But
is it any more than a Y in the pipe and a valve?
It'll be a flange and a valve.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, number 13, if I may. Commit to offer firm transportation service to delivery points in the state as part of the tariff, regardless of whether any shippers bid successfully, so on and so on. So this has to do with the transportation service delivery points.
Yeah. Representative Roses, through the chair, we'd say that should be part of the, you know, the applicant's proposal, how to deal with in-state transportation services.
And 14 has to do with having a local headquarters.
Local headquarters, you know, you should look at the applicant and let them describe how they intend to manage this. Obviously, there's going to be offices in Alaska to manage the project.
I would think that would be something you would insist on. Maybe you would take Governor Palin's old campaign office on Fifth Avenue there and say, that's it. It's a great place, and it appeared to be successful.
But it is definitely would be considered an objective-driven criteria, though. So, and the next would be local hire, item 15. Is that?
Representative Roses, through the chair, you know, what you want to propose here is a broad objective. Commit to hire. You know, what you want is for an applicant to explain more than commit to hire. You want to them to explain how they intend to use Alaskans for the jobs. And, you know, that takes, you want to see a proposal that goes much further than just commit to hire. You want to describe an objective of tell us how you're going to, you know, use Alaskans to do this work. Part of that is, okay, you know, commit to hiring. So I would broaden this up to a much broader objective in terms of describe for us your approach to dealing with, you know, hiring Alaskans for the work here.
Okay. And I appreciate the broadness of that, but I'm going to try to drill down a little bit more specific. Is the concern that you have in the wording of this that if you have a position that you're trying to hire and the you feel like the fair market value for that position would be X dollars, but you can't get anybody in the state that's not willing to do it unless they get 20 times X, and you feel like your hands are tied in terms of being able to move the project as a result of that? Is that the concern?
Representative Roses, through the chair, obviously it's going to have to be cost competitive. You know, it's going to have to be on a total cost basis, you know, using Alaskan versus, the next available resource. It's going to have to be cost competitive. It's got to be qualified, cost competitive, to meet the needs of the project.
And if I may, it does say qualified. It doesn't. These are going to be people you would probably want to hire.
Right.
I don't see this as a large impediment. People are qualified. They present themselves. They pass the exam that you insist on for people that can operate in the vicinity of the work area. You give them minimums, and you hire those that you can. I would hope that you would hire an Alaskan when it was equivalent to somebody, dare I say, from Texas, but I won't. Someone not from Alaska. Because you're going to hire a project this size requires a workforce of, you know, it's easy to say thousands. I don't know how many it actually requires, but, well, that's the right answer. I don't know how many thousands. We don't have that many people even able to work. So we're presenting you with a fairly reasonable, not a barrier, but an opportunity to become a very good partner with the state.
Yeah, Representative Gatto and, ExxonMobil recognizes, you know, this excellent opportunity for Alaskans to be trained for this sort of work and to have the opportunity for the jobs, and no question we want to work toward that. So I'd say, in our view, this is a little too specific here. You ought to broaden it up, and you ought to ask them to give you more details about how they intend to deal with the issue of hiring Alaskans. And it needs to have the aspect of being cost competitive, as Representative Roses asked.
I believe our Commerce Commissioner is actually working on that at this very moment.
Thank you.
So, and Representative Roses.
And I think I heard what you were saying. Make it a general statement of please explain your local hire qualifications and your implementation plan, as opposed to saying that you will hire them for management engine. And rather than being specific on the specific aspects, just explain your local hire procedure and plan.
Correct. That's
what you're saying. Make it more general.
Correct.
I understand that. Okay, so I got a feeling the next one's going to be where we may have a little more discussion. Waive the right to appeal the award to another applicant or the determination, and no application merits the issuance of a license. So I assume that might be one you're having a little bit of discomfort with.
Yeah, Representative Roses, through the chair, absolutely. I mean, that requirement right there removes a person's right to challenge whether the award was done correctly or not. And I have the view that will limit the number of applicants rather than open it up to greater competition.
Would it keep Exxon from applying, knowing that if you were not selected, you would not be able to appeal? Or would you say, listen, we're pretty good at this. I think we've probably got a better than an excellent chance. In fact, I think we have better than an excellent chance by far, because we've done it before, we've got the money, we've got the expertise. So let's do it, and if indeed you're not chosen, then, I mean, I'm sure you'd be discouraged, but you would then want to appeal. That's what you're after.
Representative Gatto, through the chair, you know, we're talking about one particular aspect here. We have to look at the total GEO bill when it's all put together. You asked my preference on one particular item, and I'd say my preference is that it's not in there. Do we think we can put a very competitive bid forward? Absolutely. And we think we can win. So no question. That's why we would be supportive of this competitive process. But a GEO in its current form doesn't deliver a commercially viable project, so I can't play today in the way it's written.
Let me, if I may, my concern on this point, and I was interested to get your take on it, but yesterday as part of the conversation that we had there, one of the questions that I asked the administration was, why would we not have the open season first so we know how much gas the producers would be willing to commit to the project, and then we'd size the pipe to that project, as opposed to doing it the other way around. And this part ties directly into that for me, because let's make the assumption that we get a licensee that says, okay, I'm going to build a 54-inch line, and here's where it's going to go, and here's what it's going to do. And I go to the open season, you get the producers that come in and say, okay, well, because we got to pay or play, either way, we're paying for the volume we tell you we're going to have, so we're going to underestimate our capacity, and we're going to guarantee to deliver X amount. So now, all of a sudden, a 54-inch line is not competitive. Question, and I asked this of the administration, they said, well, then they would go back and redesign the pipe. Well, if you've had an open bidding process and you had more than one bidder, and you issued a license to somebody based on a 54-inch pipe, but now you've downsized it to a 42-inch pipe, how do you know that the person in the original bid that had a 42-inch pipe didn't now have the best bid? And if you've closed out the appeal process, you have now closed out the opportunity to go back and look at who had the best 42-inch bid. And that's my concern with this. And I was wondering whether or not that was the issue that you were driving towards. But I would say the waiver, the way you characterized it, is that you would have difficulty knowing who would be willing to bid on this without the ability to waive, because question was asked, would your company want to appeal if somebody else got the bid? I guess the question would be, how would you feel about nobody else being willing to appeal if you won the bid? Because I think it works both ways. So yeah, so it's kind of a double-edged sword. If you're the winner, you don't care. But if you're not, it becomes an issue. So I appreciate your comment on that. But for me, the issue goes a little farther than just that point.
Representative Seaton has a question.
Thank you. And on that point, when we were talking to Don Bullock the other day, we were talking about clarifying that, because, and I'm wondering whether this makes any difference to your analysis here, because the right to appeal was not through the administrative appeals process, but it was to go to court. Does that make any difference that you could appeal through the administrative process of this, but you or the other person that lost wouldn't be able to appeal through the court system?
Representative Seaton, through the chair, as I understand the way this is set up, you know, it's the commissioners that are making the decision, so the option for an administrative appeal beyond them doesn't really exist. So it would have to go to court.
You mean follow up?
Yes, sir. Go ahead.
So the idea that the appeal would be made, but it would be back to the commissioners, and since they've already made a determination, that you don't think that if you brought forward other information that would sway the issuance of the license, and therefore you want to be able to go to court, or you want the other losing bidders to be able to take your right to court if you were granted the license?
Representative Seaton, through the chair, you at least need the opportunity to appeal to someone higher than the person that made the decision, so that they can review all the facts and the new any particular information. I doubt there will be new information because there's going to be, everything's going to be given and put on the table and open and transparent. So it's whether the right decision was made by the person that made it.
And following up, I guess the question is twofold. First of all, appealing it in case of your analysis saying that your bid was actually better for some other reasons, or, you know, after that, and then also going with approval by the legislature, which wouldn't be precluded as well, to ask them to turn down the person, the winning bid. But if there was appealable to the court, and since, I mean, everybody that is, including I think you guys that have talked to us, have said time is of the essence. The more years you delay, the, you know, the gas market fills up and many other things. At what point do we say, okay, we're going to give a license under an AGEA-style program? Do we say that, okay, the bidders have to accept the determination, or is it just going to be, okay, it can be delayed 4 years by going through court and going through the process, and the bidders really aren't constrained from doing it? Do you see any benefit to constraining the access to going to court as a losing bidder, or do you think that that just ought to be available to every bidder?
Well, Representative Seaton, through the chair, you know, I would make that available, and depending upon the you know, what is proposed by the applicant, there is an opportunity for the applicant to say, you know, he would continue to progress the project while that is going on. So I would leave that open in terms of let the applicant describe how they're going to deal with the project during that intervening period. That we already know, and I think AGEA, the way it's been modified, is there'll be a contract, you know, to memorialize the agreement. That contract could be challenged as well in court as to whether, you know, it's actually constitutional. So there are going to be court challenges, and I think it'll be up to the state and the applicant to determine, well, how good do we feel about where we're at, and should we go ahead while these challenges are going on? As I mentioned earlier, you know, that's one of the things we agreed to last time, is that while the court challenge was going on the constitutionality test, we would continue to progress the project, put some dollars at risk. Maybe that's something that you ought to allow the applicants to think about, propose relative to this issue here.
Representative Seaton has a follow-up.
Yeah. So, and of course, we're talking about the issuance of the license here. I mean, before, when you're talking about that, you were talking about a single negotiation, a single contract. There wasn't a competitive thing where one person was going to get issued a license. That license is probably going to get stayed while it goes through the entire court process. So are you saying that whoever might have been given the license would go ahead and proceed, even with a court stay of that license, would proceed on developing the project while it goes through court?
Representative Seaton, through the chair, we're talking hypotheticals here.
Okay.
You know, if there's a stay and you're not allowed to do it, then you got a problem. I would agree with
okay.
you.
Sure.
Hold on. Mr. Massey, are you able to recess right now and come back at 5?
Representative Gatto, I'm due to fly out tonight at 7:40, so.
At what time?
7:40, 7:50 tonight, something like that, so.
Oh, so we'd better stay. Okay, we'll just continue.
Yes.
Representative Roses.
Thank you. So the next one to be commit to negotiate prior to construction a labor project labor agreement.
Yeah, Representative Roses, through the chair, there's going to be work for union, non-union labor. I would have the applicant describe, you know, how they intend to acquire labor for this job to complete the work. I think it's premature at this point to mandate a project labor agreement. to be negotiated. I would leave that open to the applicant to determine, you know, how best to, you know, to source labor for the project.
Wouldn't it
and it's not an issue of whether labor will have access to this work. There's no question that that's going to occur because it's just the magnitude of work that's available. They're going to play a very, very important role. But mandating negotiating a project labor agreement is, in my view, is too specific at this particular point in time with what we're trying to achieve.
I'm just assuming that the possibility of a strike would be ever present, and you would look at a delay by the minute of how much the delay is costing and capitulate to changing the wages or benefits or something. That, to me, is the concept behind the agreement. Now, I agree with you. Project labor agreement could include other things, certainly non-union labor, as is allowed under Davis-Bacon, et cetera, as long as the wages are equivalent. I actually have a different concern, and that is in this market. You can't find a worker. We would have to take them literally from other projects and outbid the other projects to get them up here. This has got to be a significant part of the cost for the line. Am I correct that the labor is significant, or is the steel so expensive that the labor is barely a few percents, or is it half labor, half steel?
Representative Gatto, I apologize. I cannot recall those numbers. Labor is going to be a big part of the project. The actual percent, I can't recall right now. What you want to set up, though, is you want to create an environment where you can go and work with union and non-union labor and create the work arrangement that's necessary to achieve a successful project. Mandating in here that we negotiate a project labor agreement may not set up the right negotiating environment to get that done.
I'm not sure that requires union acquiescence to it. It simply, we think of it that way, and that if you're building a school, you got a deadline, you want to open it in September 3rd, you go get a project labor agreement, and you won't have a delay, at least in workers. And so you're agreeing to paying higher wages in return for a guaranteed opening day for school. Similarly, we need an opening day for the pipe, that is, to open the bottom end of it and have the gas flow out that end. So
yep.
Not being too conversant myself in PLAs, just knowing about them, I can understand your point of view. Representative Roses?
18 would be commit the state contribution received by the licensee may not be included in the applicant's rate base and shall not be used as a credit against the licensee's cost of service. Is that considered an objective-driven criteria?
Representative Roses, through the chair, in my opinion, no, that's not, because if we're going to make the $500 million a variable, then you know you should also allow them to determine how best that $500 million is going to be dealt with. It may be better to consider it as ownership rather than a reduction to the rate base. So I would provide the applicant flexibility to decide how they would like the state to participate in the project in that regard.
Representative Seaton?
I guess I'm trying to figure this out because, of course, one of the major objective goals is to keep the tariff as low as possible. And if we're committing $500 million to the pipe, to the process of getting the pipe in, this commitment says that money will not be considered in raising the tariff. And now what I'm hearing you say is, you don't want to have that in there so that $500 million could raise the tariff. And doesn't that directly counter one of the main stated objectives is to keep the tariff low and the state willing to contribute up to $500 million without having that calculated in the tariff? Can you explain to me why that if we would include that in the tariff calculation, why that wouldn't violate one of our basic objective criteria of keeping the tariff low?
Representative Seaton, through the chair, one applicant may actually propose that. There's no question that they take the 500 and roll it into rate base. I may be able to propose to you a lower tariff without any 500 being in the, without any of the contribution, or giving you the contribution and allowing you to have an ownership position and still beat the other applicant's tariff rate. So it's a detail around getting to the ultimate goal of the lowest tariff that you're trying to achieve. If an objective is you want to get the lowest tariff, let the applicant propose to you how they intend to deliver that. You'll be able to see what each one of them is proposing, and then you can select it. Maybe you get the lowest tariff without ever having to contribute the $500 million.
Well, and follow up, and that's in the criteria, the evaluation criteria. This is just saying if you are going to select to take the $500 million, that you're not going to roll it in and use it to increase the tariff.
Okay.
So.
Okay. Understand.
So if that's what this means, then that's not objectionable to you.
Representative Seaton, no, that's not objectionable.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Roses.
Number 19, provide a detailed description of the applicant and so on and so on. So basically, you got to tell us who you are and whether or not you have the readiness and ability to do the project. I see that as pretty specific criteria.
Representative Roses, I would agree.
Okay. So that's not a problem. And the final one, otherwise demonstrate the readiness and ability to perform the activities specified in the application in regards of doing the pipeline project.
Representative Rosa, through the chair, I would agree. It's objective.
I want to know the score.
Pardon?
I want to know the score.
Yeah.
Well, you can get that. You didn't keep track?
No, we got a scorekeeper.
Representative Seaton?
I wanted to go back to a couple of the questions I had on maybe intricacies of a couple of these things and see whether you agreed with them. On page 6, under, exactly under page 6, where it's reasonable engineering increments, and I was unsure about that definition, because it says that the additional capacity will be using the compressors or pipe size, but then it says that is substantially similar to the original compressor size and the original pipe size. Is there any reason why you would think that original pipe size for looping should be in there? I mean, if we wanted to increase capacity, if we've got a 48-inch pipeline and we want to increase capacity, is there any reason why if somebody wanted to, you know, we have a amount of capacity and we need a 36-inch pipeline to handle the additional capacity, is there any reason why we would want to say, well, no, you've got to do it with 48-inch pipe?
Representative Seaton, through the chair, we would make all of this in the applicant's proposal in terms of how they would deliver it. I think you're onto an issue, though, that it says that it's essentially similar to the original compressor size and original pipe size, which I guess one could interpret that you got to build a whole new project again. I mean, if it's 52, you got to go up to a whole loop of 52 and new compressors. Is that the way you interpret it?
That's the way I interpret it, and I was just
that
curious.
It sounds a little excessive.
Okay, so
this actually addresses the word or, compressor or pipe addition. And so you use compression as needed, then you use a pipe addition, and the word substantially similar, I believe, is about as wide open as a hole can be.
Yeah.
It's going to be cross-section will be round, be made out of steel. Substantially similar already.
Understand.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you. And another question that I had is, on the 15% cap on the rolled-in rates, is that, I know there's some disagreements on that, but is that really anything substantial? Since we're talking about initial maximum recourse rates and they're non-adjusted for inflation, everybody that's been talking about expansion is talking about the initial expansions being by compression, and for the initial several expansions be by compression. And so by the time you get 10 years down the line to where you go to an expensive looping where you would actually be increasing the rate, and if we're not adjusting anything for inflation, is that 15% is going to be insignificant probably, isn't it?
Representative Seaton, through the chair, the 15% is huge. It's too big of a risk to take.
Now, even if it's 10 years down the
line? At any time.
15% of the original recourse rate?
At any time.
Okay. And so another question is there a figure at which you as a company feel that is not so huge that it's a problem? I mean, if it's 10% on 10 years down the line without any inflationary adjustments, 10% off the original price, you're probably going to be above that anyway.
Bye. Yeah, Representative Steve, through the chair, we would say, let that be something that the applicant proposes to you in terms of how they would deal with expansions, roll-in rates, incremental rates, and so forth, in terms of what they're willing to do. We understand what the state has suggested here, so if we want to win the bid, then we need to deal with that issue in a very positive way for the state. So that.
Okay, thanks.
How would you respond if, excuse me, we established the tariff, and because of compression, the tariff went down, but you were not a beneficiary of the reduction, nor would you be forced to pay the addition later on when the rate became back to exactly what it was before. So in other words, we're guaranteeing you a tariff from the beginning, which will last whether we compress or loop or do anything. Then would you say that's fair? Because you're not going to be the beneficiary of a reduction, and you're not going to be penalized by the increase in rates.
Representative Gatto, I've not really looked at that, so it's hard for me to say to answer that question at this time.
Okay.
Representative Gatto, I would say, the items that Representative Roses took me through were the items on the pipe side. And, the pipe is the easy part of this. The pipe is not what's going to drive this. What's going to determine whether we have a commercially viable project or not is the upstream side, the resource side. And I am also suggesting that you allow the applicants to propose the upstream terms that they require to make the project viable and not mandate those as well that are listed in a G, and I just wanted to make sure that was clear.
Can I go back?
Representative Guttenberg?
On that point, I would like to go back on something that Representative Seaton said. Previous to the Stranded Gas Act, previous and between that exercise and this, and even post the GIA, don't you have the ability to simply put a plan on the table to FERC? A proposal to build a pipeline that has nothing to do with the GIA. You decide that it's economically viable for you and the producers, or you and somebody else, to build a pipeline now, and here it is. And we're delighted that the state has a concept called the GIA that they would like, but we have this, and we're going to go ahead, and we don't need to acquiesce to these conditions. We just can meet the FERC requirements.
Representative Guttenberg, through the chair, you're absolutely right. If we thought the project was commercially viable under the terms we have today, we could go to FERC and, apply for a certificate and move on. The issue is, on the upstream terms, the project is not commercially viable that we have today. We have no certainty over even how to run the economics, because we don't know what the terms are going to be, for an extended period of time, to know whether it's viable over the long term. We do know today, under the terms that we currently have in the GIA, it's not commercially viable.
Just to follow through.
Follow up.
So looking back outside of the GIA, looking back the state of Alaska and Exxon and the producers have a 30-plus year history, certainly 30 solid years of TAPS. What in our relationship with TAPS brings you to the point saying we just don't trust you to go ahead forward, and that we know in the world that, you know, within the parameters of what this state and this legislature would do, it's reasonable.
Representative Guttenberg, through the chair, it's not really a matter of trust. It's a matter of this, on this mega project, understanding what the deal is, and so that I can make an investment decision. And that requires us agreeing, you know, what the terms are between us and how much of the revenue are you going to take and how much am I going to take to be able to determine whether it's viable or not. I understand, you know.
Yeah.
Yes, we've had a long history together, and that it helps to go back and look at history. But it doesn't really matter. If you had never changed the tax rate one time, we would still require an understanding between ourselves of what the deal is on this mega project because of the magnitude and the risk that we're taking. It doesn't matter. It's a requirement that we have all around the world for these mega projects, and those projects that go forward are the ones where the resource owner, which is the state, and the leaseholders have come to an arrangement of how we're going to share this revenue between the projects. The mega projects that go forward have that understanding, and until we get to that point, we're really not going to progress the project.
If I may, well, certainly last year during fiscals, you know, when we had the great exercise, for lack of a better term, you know, the world of resource extraction in most of the world, we were trying to understand why, you know, the stability of this state and this nation. I mean, Representative Roses and his crew of guys are not going to go up to the slope and try and kidnap any Exxon employees, which is not the situation around the world. I won't hold you to that. You might have other conditions, but you know, your relationship with the state for 30 years, you know, I'm sure how these calculations go ahead. There are parameters, high, lows, expectations, you know, the median expectations through the history of a project, with risks, with costs, with market factors. You know, I think those are the things we're playing there. And from the perspective, I would not imagine that the state is outside of any of those parameters. So when we're looking to figure out what the state's role is, you know, I think we're in the world. And, you know, the terms for, you know, what we're looking for here, and you said it before, is that competitive open process. But, you know, I think certainly in some places, from my position, the state's position clashes with yours. We're looking for a more open process, an open competitive process, where and that's what a GIA is simply designed to do. And you have actually, you know, yours is not aligned with that. So, no question, just a statement.
Okay. Representative Seaton and then Representative Roses.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I guess there seems to be some confusion here, because my understanding is that GIA is a midstream, is to get a pipeline, and you're talking about upstream concessions or upstream, of which only the producers, if they build the pipeline, have any interest at all. So what you're talking about is not an open competitive process, but a closed process with just the producers having upstream concessions to make the project viable. And so it seems to me that if we're talking about a GIA, you know, we tried that route and it didn't work. And now we're saying, okay, we're going to get a pipeline in, and we're trying to get a pipeline in there and then have it be gas competitively supplied to the pipeline in an open season. And I guess what I'm trying to understand is this mixture is difficult for me to assess, but basically, I mean, if it's economic to produce the gas and it's an economically viable, not a project, but economically viable to sell the gas, I would anticipate that you would be selling the gas and as a producer, whether you have, whether you own the pipeline or not. Am I misunderstanding that?
Representative Seaton, through the chair, the upstream pays for the midstream here. The upstream revenue from the gas sales is what will pay for the cost of the pipe. Now that payment comes in the form of making a firm transportation commitment, but it's really looks through that, and you're basically paying. The upstream is paying for the construction of this project. There's no other way of getting around it because it's a basin opening project. The gas will pay for that infrastructure that is there. And until you have dealt with the upstream terms satisfactorily such that the project is viable for the producers, then we're not going to have a project. We're not going to have a successful open season, and we're not going to be able to go forward. What I'm suggesting is you allow upstream applicants to propose to you what they need to make the project go forward. A GIA, as it's currently written, does not result in a commercially viable project. So we can't make a conforming bid. So what I'm suggesting is you open that up, allow us to propose. You don't have to accept if you don't like the terms that we propose. You can reject them, or you can opt to negotiate with us. You don't have to accept them. It's very, very difficult in legislation to try to write down what's necessary to make the project viable. It's almost impossible. It's too complex. The risks are too great. But we're willing to provide through this competitive process what we think is necessary to make the project go. And that's what we're proposing for the upstream terms. Allow us the flexibility to provide you a proposal that's acceptable to us. Then you can decide whether it's acceptable to you or not.
All right. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate you being here. It's not been easy. I wanted to get some things on the record. I've heard you've said them. I just want to hear them in this committee. If a GIA were to pass today, would your company submit a proposal to build a pipeline under these conditions?
Representative Johnson, through the chair, the way a GIA is written today, the project's not viable, so we can't make a bid. We can't make a conforming bid to a GIA.
Okay. A conforming bid's key, and I have just a couple of things. If we were to make it objective, to the objective criteria, and we line this out as these are our objectives, how closely would your contracting division, I'm sure you have floors of people that write contracts, how closely would they look at a GIA and say, these are what they really want? If we're going to get this contract, we really need to meet these requirements. No, they're not required. No, they're not. No single one of them is a deal killer. So if we can't do this, we better sweeten something up. If we can't do six, we better do seven really well. How closely would your company look at that?
Representative Johnson, through the chair, we're going to try to win the bid. And so from what you've got in here, it gives us a good idea of what you want. So we're going to do our best, you know, to try to meet the what I call the minimums or must-haves as they've been described here. And if we can't, then we're going to describe over here, oh, but don't forget about us because look what we're doing for you here. And hopefully when you weigh all of that up, you know, you'll pick us. But absolutely, we will look at trying to meet, you know, the state's objectives. We may come up with something that's better than what's considered here as a must-have. No question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
That's why there's that part in there that says you can't object to the award of the bid, because Exxon could come forward and say, boy, have we got a deal for you. And in your deal, what if you do? What if you do? And we say, you know what? All things considered, I think we should go with that, and we all agree, and you've got the deal, and then the person comes back and says, but we had all 20 of these things, and they only had 17. And your answer is, too bad. You can't appeal.
Representative Gatto, I would say that's why I wouldn't put the 20 or 17 in here. I would describe the broad objective so that we don't put ourselves in a position where we give another applicant, just because we didn't meet one particular criteria, the opportunity to challenge this and bring it down. That's why I'm proposing this broad objective base where you give us the opportunity to bring it forward. And you can look at it all in a context and decide, you know, which way you want to go.
But unless you're the only bidder, there almost certainly will be an appeal.
Right. But, you know, Representative Gatto, we're trying to have a competitive process here. And AGIA, as it's currently written, it's not going to be competitive. I'm a major resource owner on the slope, and I can't play. I would think the legislature would want us to at least be in the game so you can see what we're willing to do. That's an important thing for you to consider is, you know, you got to get us in the box.
Just a few minutes ago, you referred to the state as the resource owner, and now you said, but we're a major resource owner.
Sorry. Okay. The state is the resource owner, and we're a lease owner. I apologize.
Representative Roses?
Sir, is your company throughout the exploration and other companies in producing product, have you ever been in a bidding process where you've done an RFP type project?
Representative Roses, through the chair, normally RFP project proposals are done in this particular area where you're trying to access land, access resource, where the host government is looking at what is the best case for me to develop this resource. Who is going to give me the best terms to develop the resource? What we have here is we already have a lot of the gas leased. So it's a complicating factor that makes an RFP process very difficult to work because you basically lease the land already. Most of the RFPs that, you know, have a chance of working are those where you haven't really leased the land yet and you're asking folks to come in and make proposals on how they will go forward to develop the resource. That's not what we have here. We have never done an RFP for this sort, for the particular situation we have here where the land is already leased. If you've already leased the land to the individual, then you really kind of need to deal with that individual to decide, you know, what's required to make the project go. Until you get to that point, or you take the leases back from them, you're really not in a situation, you know, that works very effectively.
Thank you.
Interesting comment. You're a global company, and you said we're entering new territory. I said, wow.
Right.
If I may follow up.
Representative Rose.
New doesn't necessarily always mean better, but I guess summarizing what I heard you say is that typically when you have RFPs, it involves not only that production of that product and the delivery of that product, but it also incorporates the lease as part of that process. And so where you may lose in the one area, you gain in the other, but you've got some value to trade off. And what I hear you saying here is that the leases have already been done. We've already bid on those. We already have it. And so we have nothing to trade off at that point except the value of the product that we're producing. And therefore, those are the concerns over having this RFP as specific it is as opposed to having it more general where you have some flexibility for the give and take and the trade and moving that around. Is that a fair summarization of what you said?
Representative Roses, that is a fair summary.
Thank you.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you. But back on tariff and pipeline considerations a little bit. Slightly different subject, carbon dioxide, CO2 emissions, 3% energy usage of the energy going down the pipeline will probably be used for compression, et cetera, which is basically the total output of Alaska's commercial and residential CO2 output now. There's a couple of considerations. One is cap and trade. If you would have to, since this project is underway, if you'd have to purchase the CO2 emissions and apply that to the tariff, have you looked at what effect that would have on the tariff?
Representative Seaton, through the chair, no, we have not looked at that.
Okay. And follow up?
Representative Seaton.
And on a general situation, if through the U.S. Congress we could, there was a proposal that would go through that would pre-allow or pre-allocate the CO2 necessary for the project, and then the pipeline operator would use hydrogen fuel cells, some other mechanism of providing that, and then was going to be able to monetize that CO2 allocation, cap and trade, and sell it. Would your feeling be that at least a high percentage of that should be allocated to reducing tariff, or should that just be left to the pipeline operator? Or is there any consideration in that aspect?
Representative Seaton, through the chair, I believe the policy should be that the pipeline owner, gets a fair return on their investment and the expenses associated with running the pipe. If there's something that they do that results in lower expenses, then, that should carry through in the tariff. If it's something that they take, action they take that increases the expenses and it's a legitimate expense, then it needs to be included in the tariff, is the approach we would take. Now, I'd have to say that is an answer coming off the top of my head, and we have not really looked at that in any detail.
Okay, and just following up one last. I appreciate that, and it's a significant issue, as with the Supreme Court decisions and all these things. But my understanding is there may be an effort in Congress to pre-allow that CO2, and I think it'll be a very significant thing that we make sure. I guess I would like to ask if that might be one of the 21st ones that we need to put in here, is that a commitment that if that goes forward and then that CO2 is available for sale, that a great proportion of that would be allocated to reduce the tariff. But that would be something that you would kind of support as a general provision then.
Representative Seaton, I'm sorry, I just have not looked at that enough to be able to give you a good answer on that.
I don't think he was going to support another one.
Yeah, we can't get through 12.
If I understand your earlier testimony, you'd be happy to go up two floors to the third floor and talk to the governor about some way to move the project forward. Would that be to take that previous administration's agreement that's accumulated a fair amount of dust now and say, here it is? Or would you have a different agreement that you could write up?
Representative Gatto, total flexibility in that regard. We can start at the very first place, which is each party describes the objectives that they want to achieve. And once you get a common understanding of the objectives, then you start talking about, okay, how are we going to achieve those objectives? And then you start describing, okay, well, what are your responsibilities toward those objectives and what are mine? And then you start putting that down in writing. We can go all the way back to that standpoint if that's what the administration wants to do. Or we can pick up the old contract and work on it. We're totally flexible in that regard.
There may not even be a copy of it.
I have.
Yeah, and you
knew that. I knew that. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I want to go back to a little bit about the taxes that we talked about earlier and just kind of brushed over. If we were in a situation where in some form or fashion, let's say that we meet some of your objective-driven fundamentals or not, and that we were to give you some certainty on taxes at a certain percentage sooner than later, if we were to do that in this piece of legislation, how heavy would that weigh in your previous comment that it's not an economically viable project at this point? If we were to be able to give you some of that certainty that seems to be or is important, I recognize the importance. If we were able to do that in this, how would that play, and what would that do towards moving you to more getting, you know, more likely to participate?
Representative Johnson, through the chair, you know, we're going to have to deal with predictable and durable fiscal terms for all aspects of Alaska Take, you know, for this project. I don't know how we can do that in a piece of legislation. It took 400 pages to do it last time. It's very extensive in terms of describing how you're going to achieve that. Of course, any move in that direction to provide additional certainty is great, but it's going to have to you know, encompass the whole thing. And that's why we're suggesting that you allow us the flexibility to propose to you, you know, what we would need, and then you can look at that and decide if it's worth you taking that on or not.
Thank you.
Representative Roses.
Thank you, through the chair. You've made it, I think, abundantly clear that as this bill currently exists, that you don't feel your company would feel that the economic viability of this project, and so there probably would not be likely to be bidding on it according to this criteria. And you've spent a great deal of time working with and negotiating with and talking to the other producers, and I don't expect you to, you know, have the final answer on their behalf, but you surmise that their feeling is probably somewhat the same as yours.
Representative Roses, through the chair, I'm just not going to speak from our partners.
You're much more political than you thought.
let the partners answer that question. You'll get that access to them, I think, in the next couple of days. So,
when you go to the airport tonight, you know, sounds like you'll be flying in the evening unless you're going to hang in Seattle. Tomorrow you'll be in
Houston, Texas.
Houston. And I'm sure you're going to march into the boardroom. The question is going to be, and your answer is going to be along the lines of, we had a meeting, and what would it be?
Representative Gatto, we got to keep working at it. Got to keep working at it.
And they're going to say you flew all the way to Houston to say we're going to keep working at it?
Keep working at it.
Get back to Alaska.
I mean, this project is too important. We're never going to give up. We're not never going to give up. We've got to find a way to make this project go. You know, and the thing that keeps me encouraged is that, you know, you can see a way to make this project go if we can get together with the state and agree on how we're going to share the revenue. If we can agree that, this project is going to go. And you're going to have ExxonMobil, BP, and ConocoPhillips lined up trying behind it, making it happen. And we just got to get to the point that we can agree the upstream terms that are going to make the project go. We want to make it go.
I watched on Gavel to Gavel the economist from ConocoPhillips talking about the future price of gas, which appears to be not as good as it is today. Do you believe with that determination?
Representative Gatto, we're not in the business of forecasting gas prices.
Oh, yes, you are.
we don't know what the price of gas is going
to
be.
No, I understand that. Don't we wish we don't know tomorrow's gas price.
That's right.
But I probably know the long-term guess better than tomorrow's guess, because I can't tell which direction it's going tomorrow. But I think in the long term, if it's $7, is probably a fair price for a long-term guest, if not $14, but not less than $5. And I think the project is still viable at $5. Why, I'm sure we need to lift this gas and send it to a market, especially to the Midwest and to Alberta. And I think, like you, we want to see this happen. And I think you'd be a good partner. And maybe other people that are as good a partner, but that doesn't diminish your ability to be a good chin, or is this confidential, or but do you get to discuss it with them, or are we sort of working from distant positions and saying, well, here's what they offered, and then you respond to it in committee, and then they come and talk to us, or do you have one-on-one with the administration?
Representative Gatto, the governor has made herself available anytime we've asked to visit with her, and always available, you know, for a meeting with ExxonMobil management. The commissioners and so forth have decided this is the way they want to go, and they don't want to negotiate with us. I mean, that's clear. And you know, I understand that. That's well within their right to decide how they want to progress this project. And as I said, we're willing to work within the framework that they described if we get move it to an objective-based approach and allow us to describe, you know, what we need to make the project viable. That's fine. We're happy to work that way.
And you're flying back to Houston on a commercial jet, and we're offering a $500 million inducement. I'm guessing we can throw another jet in there as an inducement if it would help.
I bet we could.
I couldn't help it. Is there any other testimony? Representative Roses?
I asked this, and I referenced it earlier, but I haven't asked you the question. I asked the administration yesterday in terms of this project about whether or not the open season should be held before you issue a license to build a pipe so that you're designing a project for what you actually need. What's your opinion on whether the open season should come before the licensee or after the licensee for the pipeline?
Representative Roses, I have not pondered that question, so it's a difficult one for me to answer. I understand your point and the concern about not knowing, you know what the project's going to be. The issue I have is we need to understand what the deal is before we get started. So we've got to agree those upstream terms to know that we've got the confidence to go forward and start progressing this project. So in some respects, I understand your issue. But at the same time, I've got a requirement to understand that this project is commercially viable before we start down the path of trying to make it happen. So I'm not sure I answered your question, but
you didn't. But I
tried.
I understand the difficulty in trying to get that answer. I appreciate that, and while you've given me the microphone, I want to thank you for the opportunity and the latitude you've given me in the line of questioning and. And I certainly appreciate the efforts that you made in trying to answer those. And I guess one of the situations that I'm faced with is I guess one of the advantages of not having been part of the discussions over the last couple of years is simply the fact that I'm not tainted by any preconceived ideas. And so as a result of that, I may be asking questions that have been asked 15 times before, and I didn't hear a lot of snickering when I asked them, so I would assume that maybe wasn't necessarily the case. But I appreciate the opportunity to have these open discussions, and I'm going to continue in that same line of questioning with everybody that comes here before I start making my decision on where we need to go and what changes we may potentially need to make. So I appreciate the opportunity to have that input, and I, again, thank the chair for the latitude in being able to do that.
And if I can add, I think you should know there was relatively little discussion in the previous proposal. It was presented to us. We spent some time here over the summer, and what we knew about it, certain points of it were rejected, and so we're back here with an entirely new governor, entirely new proposal, and I'm kind of glad you're here. I appreciate that, and I'm going to let Representative Guttenberg make a comment now.
Thank you, and I just want to give you the perspective that I come back with a quote from the governor's pipeline, big gas line consultant, Pedro Van Mieris, if I may. That was released after the this administration game, and this is a February 1st memo to Jim Clark that says, despite the boisterous politics of Alaska, the state has never adjusted fiscal terms to producers in a way that is unreasonable compared to international practices in developed nations. On the balance, the state of Alaska has been a reliable business partner with respect for law and a well-functioning democratic system. There's absolutely no need to treat Alaska as a banana republic in order to secure the gas line.
And that's from our expensive consultant.
Yeah, that's from about $700 an hour.
And how do I get on his payroll?
Yeah.
I think he's out of work at the moment. go around the table. Representative Edgerton, did you want to make a final comment? Representative Seaton? Representative Roses?
I think I had more than my share. Thank you.
Representative Johnson?
Other than thank you for showing up, have a good flight out.
Thank you. And I should go find somebody in the administration and you and take you both out to a pizza party or something. Not a very elaborate dinner, something where we're not distracted by things.
Be happy to do that.
Maybe sit down and I think chat is too gentle a word with that. I certainly appreciate you coming as far as you have come and your willingness. We'll probably ask you to come back again if that's okay with you. Remember, Houston is flat and this place is mountainous and diversity is...
It's beautiful.
Absolutely beautiful. With that and no further comments, this meeting is adjourned. That red light goes out.